I'm just going to end on, where do you see this brand 10 years from now? Certainly different than 10 years ago. So what's your hope for what WWE is in 10 years?
10, 20, 30 years from now, there's no reason why we can't be as big or bigger than Disney.
It's going to get taken over by his idiotic daughter and his doofus son-in-law and the rest of his stupid family. His idiotic daughter and idiotic daughter and
idiotic daughter.
It's business time, baby.
The Sala Monster sounds off.
My client.
Mama Monster.
Conquered the street.
You like fighting a woman?
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
Come over here and fight me.
Delete. You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
Welcome to episode 572 of the Sala Monster Sounds Off here for Veterans Day, Sunday, November 11, 2018. I am the Sala Monster. First, before we move forward here, a salute to all of the men and women who have served in the armed forces here on Veterans Day. I know we have quite a few people either actively serving, some people are deployed, listening to this show, or previously served, who listen to this podcast, so I just wanted to acknowledge them up front and thank them for their service. This week's episode is sponsored by The Ridge. You heard me promote them during my Evolution review. It is a wallet, but not just any wallet. It is a slim front pocket wallet with RFID blocking technology that protects you from data theft and possible identity theft. And they don't just look like a quality product, they feel like it as well. They come in titanium, aluminum, and carbon fiber, and over a dozen different styles and colors. I have two of them in my possession, one with a money clip and one with a cash strap, which I personally prefer. Both of them will hold your cash pretty securely, so you don't have to worry about it falling out. There were a few questions people had asked about that when I first mentioned the product, and in all the weeks that I've been using the wallet, I have not had an issue with any money or anything falling out. I have the burnt titanium one, which looks really cool. But you could also get the titanium version if you wanted to in black. They have a gunmetal color. For a limited time, you can get 10% off your first Ridge wallet with free worldwide shipping no matter where you are. All you have to do is go to ridgewallet.com/Sala Monster. And make sure you use the promo code SALAMONSTER at checkout. So as long as you use that link, the code should already come up when you go to checkout, but just double check and make sure. And again, that link is ridgewallet.com/SALAMONSTER. You can get 10% off right now, courtesy of The Sound Off. If you'd like to contribute to the show via PayPal, you can always do so on thesalamonster.com. $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout out here on this podcast. I want to say thank you this week to the Portland pop star Paul Hamilton, John Loose Cannon Lopez, Deadpool James Herrera, the Florida Freebird Bryant Becerra, Out of Control Cody Thomas, Beast Mode Brock Joseph, Hot Stuff Hector Pena, Velvet Revolver Robert Murray, Steven Handyman Halistick, The Dirty from the 530 Gabriel Sanchez, The Show Off Corey Van Dam, The Malaysian Mastermind Samuel T, The Chicago Slayer, Willie Eichard. I hope Mama Eichard is doing well. Billy Hardcore Habibi. Final Boss, Brian Dudley. Glory Hound, Keith Doherty. No Way Out, Nick Fugit. The British Brainbuster, Andre Delabov. Interfere and I'll Kill You, Ingo Wabu. California Kid, Anthony Clark Jr. Forgotten Fan, Frankie Blyce. He does not watch the product anymore, which I'm sure a lot of you can relate to, the WWE product, that is. But he keeps up with it via this podcast, and I cannot tell you how many times that I've heard that from people this year, which is kind of scary, actually. But that's why I thought the Forgotten Fan nickname here would work well for Frankie. There's a lot of forgotten fans out there that WWE has neglected. Also want to say thank you to Baruto Dark 1993, The Gospel Gangsta, and James from Rockford, Illinois. Thank you for the love in iTunes. And shout out to Nuclear Heat Graphics. This is a guy you want to check out. He does wrestling, horror, cartoon, animation prints. He's also available for commissions. including logos or family portraits, posters, greeting cards, whatever your needs are. Nuclear Heat Graphics is who you want to be talking to. He is a very talented dude, and you can check out his work at nuclearheatgraphics.com. Reach out to him there, or you can reach out to him via email at nuclearheatgraphics@gmail.com. Super Sock Jose Lothario, who, if you were a WWE fan back in the mid-90s, you remember as the man who trained Shawn Michaels. And if you grew up in Texas back in the 70s, you probably remember him as one of the all-time great top babyface stars. He died this week, the age of 83. He was a big star wherever he worked. He worked in Mexico, he worked here in the States, a lot down in Texas, although not exclusively there, but that was sort of the area he was seen most in. He did work a lot in Florida as well. He won a bunch of NWA titles down there. For better or worse, though, he's going to be remembered as the trainer of the Heartbreak Kid Shawn Michaels. That's what the vast majority of the stories that I've seen done on him this week have headlined with. And it's all because of that one little run that he had there in 96 into the early part of 97 where he managed HBK. They brought him in for the boyhood dream chase going into WrestleMania 12. Shawn Michaels went back to his roots. They did those video packages. And Jose stuck with him. I'm still not quite sure why, now that I look back on it. I mean, it kind of made sense for the story they were telling for him to be part of the build-up to WrestleMania 12. But frankly, I don't know that it did Shawn Michaels any favors in the cool factor department to have this old guy managing him for the remainder of the year. Maybe that's why people turned on him by the time he got to the Garden in November that year. But yeah, Jose stuck with him for almost an entire year. And really, it's more accurate to say that Jose was one of the men who trained Shawn Michaels. He was not the only man. The other person was this guy, Ken Johnson, but I rarely see his name mentioned. So if you read Shawn's first book, that's the Heartbreak and Triumph book, Michaels claims that Jose really only trained him for 2 months at the start of his career. He praised him. He said he learned a lot from him, got a lot of life advice and just general advice on the business and how to conduct yourself, keep your mouth shut and your ears open, that sort of thing. But he said after 2 months, Jose said that he already had the hang of it. And Jose was trying to get Shawn booked in Mid-South because Jose was friendly with Bill Watts. So he sort of, or Shawn figures what happened. I don't know that he knew this for sure, but he figures Jose put a good word in for him with Watts and that it would be, good for him to work with some of the stars in that territory at the time. Jose also, by the way, trained Gino Hernandez. And I have a mailbag question a little bit later about Gino that I'm going to answer. Because as big as Shawn Michaels went on to become, Gino could have been as big or nearly as big had he not died so young. But we'll get to that question a little bit later. WWE put a statement out about Jose's death, saying that despite never winning a WWE-sanctioned championship or competing at WrestleMania, Jose Lothario made a lasting mark on the WWE universe by simply agreeing to train a cocky teenager from San Antonio, Texas, a cocky teenager who grew up to become WWE Hall of Famer Shawn Michaels. And they had a quote in here from Shawn saying, "I think every young boy who lived in Texas knew who Jose Lothario was." This is what he told WWE Magazine back in 1996. This is not a current quote. He said, "I first saw him on TV when I was 12. He was the first superstar to come across my television screen. He is a legend in San Antonio, Cuba, Mexico, and just about everywhere." And it mentioned that he briefly displayed his talents in WWE by humbling Jim Cornette in a match at In Your House 10, Mind Games. Now, I remember that match. I remember that pay-per-view primarily for the main event, which is one of the all-time great WWE pay-per-view main events. But I remember that match. It only went about a minute, thank God, with Jim Cornette and Jose Lothario. Of course, Jose won. And I remember, the thing I remember about it was Cornette came out to the ring. They came out alone. Cornette came out to Vader's theme song. And Jose came out to Sexy Boy, which was hilarious. That was 96. So that would have made him, let's see here, he was born in 1934. So he would have been 62. He would have been 62 years old at the time. Well, you know, I guess him coming out to Sexy Boy at 62 is no less ridiculous than Sean coming out to it at 53. So he and Sean also wrestled a tag team match on Monday Night Raw once back in 96 against Vader and Jim Cornette, which Vader and Cornette won. Fast forward to Survivor Series in Madison Square Garden that year, the night that Sean lost the championship to Psycho Sid. Jose played into the finish of that match, if you remember, when Sid grabbed one of the television cameras and he whacked Jose in the chest with the camera. And Jose fell to the ground and he was faking a heart attack on the floor. Sean was distracted and that led to Sid beating him for the championship. Now, Jose was back on WWE television in 1999 during the Attitude Era. I don't know how many people remember this. I barely remembered it myself until I saw a mention of 99 and I was like, 99? And I was thinking about it. I said, you know what? I have a vague memory of him being on television, but I couldn't remember if it was on Raw or what the context of it was. And what it was is that WWE did a show in Sean's hometown of San Antonio. And it turned out it wasn't Raw. It was Sunday Night Heat. And they had not won on this particular episode. They had not won but two Lion's Den matches. They had one between Owen Hart and Steve Blackman. And then another impromptu one between Triple H and the Big Boss Man. Which I definitely did not remember until I went back and I watched it. Is like amazing to watch. Like even those early Heat episodes were must see and they were worth watching back then. And they had big names on them. It's incredible sometimes to go back and watch that stuff. But they had a segment on that show at the beginning with Vince McMahon. Vince McMahon was out there with Shane and the Stooges. And this was right after Sean had been attacked, I think the week before, on television. On Raw, when that was when they found Sean bloody in the parking lot. I think he was taking time off to finally have back surgery. So they wrote him off the show. So Vince is out there. He's talking about Shawn Michaels. And all of a sudden, they spot Jose Lothario sitting in the crowd, like deep, like five rows in the crowd. So they invite him to come into the ring. And Jose comes into the ring. He ends up shoving Vince. But Jose gets beaten down by Patterson and Briscoe and Vince. And that would have been the last time that we saw him on WWE television. He was never inducted into their Hall of Fame. 96 was the last year, I think, of the WWE Hall of Fame before they resurrected it in 2004. But a few months later in 99, he and Sean opened the Shawn Michaels Wrestling Academy. And I found the original announcement for it from a Bill Banks, an old Bill Banks column on WWE.com back in 99, and it said that it described it at the time as a joint venture between Sean and Jose, and that they would be joined by Rudy Boy Gonzalez and Ken Johnson as the trainers, the same Ken Johnson who helped train HBK. Not long after that, Sean and Jose had some kind of falling out, and it's never been publicly revealed, to my knowledge, what the nature of their falling out was. I don't think either one of them ever publicly commented on there being a falling out. I figure it had to be, and this is just guessing, of course, I figure it has to be one of two things. It was either Sean maybe didn't like the way that Jose was training people. Maybe he thought he was a little, you know, old school. I don't know. More likely, let's be honest, it had to do with money. It had to do, I'm sure somehow, some way, it always comes down to money. And so it was probably some kind of business disagreement. Whatever it was, Jose left and the school continued on without him. But I don't know that the two of them ever patched up their differences. He did have nice things to say about Jose in his book. It's not like he completely ignored him. He didn't talk about him, I don't think, in his Hall of Fame speech, which doesn't mean anything. But it would be a shame if they didn't speak for many, many years for some petty reason. So let's get right into it here. Raw last Monday was overseas. They were in Manchester, England. And the Twitter poll had roughly 3,300 votes. 14% thumbs up. 24% thumbs down. 62% said they did not watch. It's been several months now. And I think the didn't watch option paints a pretty good picture of those who have given up on the product and primarily stick to podcasts and YouTube shows at this point to get them by. I'm debating doing away with the option going forward because I've already gotten a pretty good sense week to week, pretty consistently, of the fact that there are a lot of people who are not watching, or if they watch, they literally, you know, maybe tune in for a segment, don't like what they see, and turn it off. And I'm thinking about just reverting back to the old thumbs up, thumbs down format for the people who actually watched the show. I've gotten a lot of divided feedback on this over the last several weeks. A lot of people want the option gone. They just don't like it being there. What's the point? If you didn't watch the show, why are you voting? A lot of people want the option to stay, in part so that they can view the results, because Twitter does not allow for you to look at the results unless you actually vote, which I think is completely stupid. There should be some kind of view results option for everybody, but they don't have that. So this gives people the ability to chime in and say, I didn't watch, and then they can see the results. The poll, again, already confirmed what I figured, which is that a lot of people aren't really watching the show anymore. Even if you assume that there are some troll votes, there's not 62. That number is inflated. Yeah, but that number isn't inflated by 20%. That's still a lot of people who are not watching Raw week to week. And the only reason I really would be keeping the option now if I left it is for the people who want to see the results and not just vote thumbs down on a show that they didn't watch. So I leave that in your hands as far as what I should do going forward. You guys can let me know what you think I should do. Fightful.com broke the news this week that starting tomorrow night, Monday Night Raw is chopping off its third hour overrun. I got you excited there for a second, didn't I? WWE or USA, one or the other, has made the decision to keep the show a, quote, firm 3 hours going forward, and Raw will no longer have the overrun of 5 or 10 or 15 minutes that they've had for many, many years now. That it's had going back to the Monday Night War period, really, in the late 90s. SmackDown, of course, already has a hard stop every week at 10 p.m. on Tuesdays. Once the reality of it is this. Once Raw went to 3 hours permanently back in 2012, there really was no need for an overrun. At all. I'll even go back further than that and say there's been no need for it since WCW died. But certainly since Raw went to the three-hour format, there has been absolutely no reason for there to be an overrun of the show every single week. So this is good news. You know, less Raw in any way is good news. Now we just need them to lop off that third hour entirely, and that'll be a step in the right direction. You know, baby steps here, though. Baby steps. It's a minor thing in the grand scheme of things. It's only 5 or 10 minutes, typically. But again, I never understood the need for the overrun. I guess maybe there's ratings reasons for it, but apparently people think, oh, ratings don't matter anymore. Even less of a reason to have an overrun. But when Nitro went off the air, there really was no purpose for it. But that was because that was the entire genesis of it back in the day, to compete against WCW. Eric Bischoff was always trying sneaky little things, you know, like starting Nitro 3 minutes earlier than Raw. You know, so then Raw, I can remember the commercials back in the mid-90s, like it was yesterday. They made such a big deal, like it was some big announcement. Starting this Monday, Raw is going to start at 7:57 p.m. instead of 8 o'clock. Tune in, 3 whole extra minutes of action, which probably would end up being somebody on the microphone talking. But it was like such a big deal. Ooh, it's going to start 3 minutes earlier just to try to get the jump on WCW. And then, of course, Nitro would go off the air 10 minutes late every week with random NWO beatdowns. So Raw would go over. We have to compete, so we're going to go over too. And there really was no need for that once Nitro pretty much kicked the bucket. So this is positive news, but we're still not where we need to be yet. They did a show-long angle on Monday involving Kurt Angle. They did an angle involving Angle, where he interrupted Baron Corbin in the opening segment. Corbin had appointed himself the captain of Team Raw in the Men's Survivor Series elimination match. He will not be competing in the match because of his duties, although Shane McMahon is the commissioner of SmackDown and he is wrestling, so none of this makes any sense. But he will be the team captain. He has picked Braun Strowman, Drew McIntyre, and Dolph Ziggler for the team. Kurt challenged him to a match where if he won, he would not only be the captain of Team Raw, much as he was last year, but he would be able to compete in the match. And Corbin did accept the challenge. Later in the show, he left early, though. He was running scared all night of Braun Strowman. And, of course, Braun being pissed at Corbin because of what Corbin did to him at Crown Jewel, hitting him from behind with the championship. So before leaving, he put Drew McIntyre in his place to take on Kurt Angle. So we had Kurt Angle versus Drew McIntyre in the main event. Kurt worked a few matches with Drew at the end of his TNA run. In fact, their last match together, which is kind of eerie, was also in Manchester, England, in this very city. That was on Impact back in 2016. I went back and I watched that last match they had, the Impact match where Drew won. And it's a hell of a match. Kurt put Drew over at the end of that match. He tapped out to a crossface. That was by Angle's request. That was a match that Kurt had asked for at the time. He wanted to do the honors for Drew, at the time Drew Galloway, on his way out. So how fitting it would be for us to be back here in Manchester for round three, because I believe Kurt, I think Kurt beat Drew in their first match. Drew won the second match. And so this technically was their third, the rubber match, I guess. And this was not as good. Decisively not as good as those matches. In the last 2 years, I guess it's almost 3 years now, it, you know, with all of his injuries, this guy, he's probably got the body of a 60-year-old. He still stays in great shape, Kurt does, but this is not the Kurt Angle of old. I still think you have people out there who expect that this guy is going to come out and be kind of the machine that he used to be, and he just isn't. You know, and it showed here. And the way they booked this, they booked it for McIntyre to dominate. So it wasn't just the fact that Kurt's older and his body isn't what it used to be. This was also in part by design, the way this match was booked, to make Drew look like a beast and to make Angle look like basically like an old guy. Because that's what he totally came across as in this match. And Kurt got some offense in. It wasn't a squash, but it was depressing to watch Kurt Angle out there getting his ass whooped so decisively. And, you know, I said during my Crown Jewel review, I said Kurt losing to Dolph Ziggler in that first round of the World Cup really killed whatever drawing power he may have still had, at least in my eyes, as far as like a big singles match. Because if you're going to build to a big Kurt Angle singles match at WrestleMania, but you have him in some random tournament first round match in Saudi Arabia going out there and losing to Dolph Ziggler, I'm sorry, but that's going to, you know, pretty much kill whatever interest or appeal that there's probably going to be in seeing Kurt Angle wrestle a singles match. And I'm not saying Dolph is a bad wrestler. Dolph is you know, garbage or anything like that. He's not. But you can only start and stop with the same person for so long and tease it for so long before you just stop caring, which is what happened to me with Dolph Ziggler a long time ago. It's funny, you go back and listen to earlier sound-offs from years ago, and I'm a big proponent and a big advocate for Dolph. And, you know, I'm not against him getting kind of the little push he's getting now. But I bet if you go back and listen to that and listen to a bunch of those rants, especially after Survivor Series in 2015, when it looked like, with Roman being out hurt and doing what they did where he was like the sole survivor when Sting helped him pin Seth Rollins in that match when Sting debuted, it was like, wow, they have a real opportunity here. Especially with an opening, there's clearly a roster opening here at the top of the card. Maybe they're actually going to do something with Dolph Ziggler. And what did they end up doing? I think they did some dumb angle where they fired him. They fired him and Ryback, and they came back a couple months later. And of course, they didn't do shit with him. So at that point, you throw your hands up in the air and say, fuck it, who cares? Who could possibly care? That's been my attitude with him now for a long time. So watching that, in my eyes, it didn't really, you know, do any favors for wanting to see Kurt in some kind of big future match. So there really is no great big Kurt Angle singles match left, I don't think, at this point, that can get me excited. Those days are over. Him against Daniel Bryan, him against Seth Rollins, yeah, those are probably two of the best guys you could put him in the ring with at this point for him to work with, who could probably still get like a truly, maybe they could get a truly great match out of him, but there really are no Kurt Angle, what I would call, dream matches left. So then he lost here to Drew. And I didn't hate it. you would think that this is building up to some kind of rant about why are they doing this to Kurt Angle. Au contraire, that is not what this is. It was sad to see him booked like that, but according to, there's a report on the Sports Illustrated site, and always take what you read on there with a grain of salt, because it is not always accurate. Even though it's got the Sports Illustrated seal, it's not always accurate. But they mentioned there that the way the match was booked here on Monday was Kurt's idea. That Kurt Angle and Vince McMahon together conceived of the idea for it to go down the way that it did. Kurt pitched it to Drew himself to let him know, here's what we're going to do, and this is how I want it to go down. You could tell from the end of his Impact run that he really does see McIntyre as something special. This is why I can see this report being true. He did the same thing in Impact when he left. He wanted to lose to him. He wanted to put him over because he obviously saw something in him. So I don't have any trouble believing that he would want to do the same thing here. You know, he's a selfless guy. Kurt reminds me a lot of Chris Jericho. Chris Jericho, you could talk about Jericho. He's conceited. He thinks so much of himself and all this stuff. Well, there's a reason for that. If you look at his body of work, Jericho has done a lot of shit that a lot of people have not done across multiple promotions. And yeah, he's older and physically he doesn't look the same as he used to look. But Jericho's out there doing everything in his power to keep his stock as high as it can be. A lot of these guys leave WWE, and you never hear from them again. So I think that's a credit to Jericho. But the thing about Jericho is, he never came across as somebody who was sort of conceited, like he's a guy who doesn't like losing or anything like that. He lost to plenty of guys. If anything, I would say Jericho probably lost too many times. But there are a few top guys like that, if you look at their body of work, who come across as being very selfless in that they will put the company or put the business or put, you know, the younger guys before themselves, and it's not a big deal if they lose, you know, a bunch of matches. Not everybody is like that. I would put Kurt in that class. Rock, I think, was the same way also in his original run. Back in the early 2000s, Rock was in there with a lot of guys that, you know, maybe he shouldn't have been in there with. And Rock never came across to me either as being somebody who, you know, had to win every single match. Like frankly, not just Triple H, but Steve Austin. I'm not saying Steve Austin buried people, although clearly he did with Jeff Jarrett by not wanting to work with him. But, you know, even Austin was a very paranoid guy who was protective of his spot. You know, I've heard those stories before. So, you know, I don't know that I would put Austin even in that class. Rock, I would. So, I found it sad, but I love the fact that they put McIntyre over as strong as they did on this show. You could argue, well, how impressive really is it if Kurt is made to look so weak? Wouldn't it have been better for Kurt to be booked like a machine and have Drew beat that version of Kurt Angle? The problem is, I don't think that version of Kurt Angle really exists anymore. Although I would agree, that could have been, he could have been given a little more offense to make it a little more competitive. But they clearly see the value in building McIntyre up as a top guy. And they're going for it. You know, him tapping out Kurt Angle to his own move. He beat him with the ankle lock. That was huge. And it's nice to see them using one of the old guys to really put over a younger guy who is on the rise. You know, if anything, we need to see more of that. I'm getting real sick and tired, I got to tell you, of seeing all the old guys these days. And, you know, they're coming back for a payday, and that's fine. They're entitled to do that. I never thought I would say anything like that. I like nostalgia as much as anybody. I used to get excited when they would have a big name coming back, big WrestleMania match, you know, whoever it was. But now, it just feels like it happens every single week. It happens so often that it loses whatever special feeling it may have had. Crown Jewel was a great example of that. Hulk Hogan, Shawn Michaels, Triple H, The Undertaker, Kurt Angle. You know, what is this, an all-star show? What about everybody else? I mean, obviously that's not what the Saudi prince wanted, so he got all these big names. But even after the Saudi show, he had Trish and Lita. They're wrestling matches on Raw like it's nothing. It's too much all at once. It's too much. Too much nostalgia at the expense of the newer talent. And here, they use one of those old stars exactly the way that they should have to make Drew look like a star. And I said on this podcast months ago, and I'm sure I'm not the only one, But I can only speak for myself here. It was many months ago, and I made the comment. I said, if Drew McIntyre is not a champion by or before WrestleMania 35, then there is something wrong with the people making decisions in this company. You can tell lately that they're taking their time with it, that they're all in on McIntyre. They're building it slowly. He would have gotten there regardless, I think. But I also think Roman Reigns leaving, you know, taking a leave of absence, it's only going to help his cause. You know, it sounds kind of shitty to say that, but, you know, Roman going down when he did opens up opportunities for other people that maybe wouldn't have been there. And Drew, I would put at the top of that list. I think he benefits maybe more than anybody. They need somebody to help fill those shoes, and I think Drew can be that guy as a babyface, ultimately. I think he could be the guy to do it. But what Kurt did here was huge, and with Kurt, if they do want to build him up for a big singles match at WrestleMania, then I think they've got to go with a Rocky story. You make it a redemption story, similar to what they did with Ric Flair heading into that retirement match at WrestleMania 24. You had Flair, he was losing and losing and had no confidence in himself. And then finally they said, look, if you lose one more match, you're done. You're going to be forced to retire. And suddenly Ric Flair went on a win streak until Shawn Michaels beat him. I'm not saying they have to make it where if Kurt loses his next match, he's got to retire. You don't have to copy that exact same story. But he could lose some more, and then maybe after he has a strong showing in the Rumble, maybe he starts winning again. Until he gets matched up with another young guy at WrestleMania, and ultimately he falls short. But does he still have that last one great singles match left in him? You know, I really think it's going to come down to who he's in the ring with. Because I think that version of Kurt Angle really just doesn't exist anymore. Corbin booked Rollins to defend the Raw Tag Team titles against AOP. No Dean Ambrose. Dean was nowhere to be found. So this was a handicap match that was actually way more competitive than I thought it would be. It was 2-on-1. I would not have had it take 10 minutes for AOP to beat one man, even if that guy was Seth Rollins, but Rollins does the babyface in peril stuff, you know, very well. Powerbomb neckbreaker combo for the win. AOP, your new Raw Tag Team Champions, which they should be. The problem is, there isn't anybody in this division who can beat them. You know, Rude and Gable, The Ascension, don't make me laugh. McIntyre and Ziggler, they don't look like they're really going to be going after the tag titles again. Been there, done that. The Shield is broken. So that leaves what? The Revival? Do we really have any faith left in these people to push those two guys? These people have no goodwill with me. I'm all out of goodwill. I only have bad will left. Is that even a word? If it's not a word, I just created it. I don't have goodwill. I have bad will. And no faith that they're actually going to seriously push the Revival. So these titles may be in limbo for a while. After the match, Dean Ambrose did finally show up. And he said, you want to know why I did what I did? And then instead of telling us, he just gave Rollins dirty deeds and he walked off. The rest of the show was mostly a bore. We had another Riot Squad. Oh my God. Another Riot Squad match against Sasha, Bayley, and Natty. I think there is some sort of sixth circle of hell where what all they do is they strap you down to a chair and they put a television in front of you and they just play all of these matches on a loop. Who could possibly care anymore about any of this? There's never any repercussions. It doesn't mean anything. It doesn't lead to anything except more matches. This time, they tried to change it up a little bit. They had a pre-match promo where Natty said she was wearing her father's sunglasses to the ring to honor him. Why she was doing this all of a sudden, I have no idea. Why you would wear sunglasses indoors, I don't know. You probably are a douche if you do that, but there she is, wearing sunglasses indoors. Almost 20 minutes this match went. Almost 20 minutes. You want to know the great finish they went with? No finish. It just stopped. The match just stopped. Natty had the sharpshooter on Sarah Logan, I believe it was. And Ruby Riott grabbed the Anvil sunglasses. And it was like she was holding them hostage. You would think she had a small child and she was threatening to break them, and Natty, of course, was saying, no, 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 don't do it. And finally, she snapped the glasses in half. And Natty cried, and she was slobbering all over herself. That's how this ended. This sucked. This sucked. And I, look, I'm all for the heels doing heel things. What she did didn't bother me. I thought it was ridiculous. Some of the comments, thankfully, they were kept to a minimum that I saw on Twitter. And like when WWE tweeted out like video of what happened, you should see these. Oh my God, it frightened me. It frightened me. I get kayfabe and all that is still alive in some small circles, but holy shit, you've got to see some of these. I wish I would have kept those comments. I would have read them here on the show. I wish I would have kept those comments. It was frightening. Some of the people posting, I can't believe Natty did that. She should be, Ruby, she should be suspended. This is going too far. First crown jewel with the Saudis and now this. What's wrong with this company? Like, oh my, I got a migraine reading some of these comments. So I guess on some people it was effective. Not on me. Apollo Crews got a win over Jinder Mahal. Former WWE champion, Jinder Mahal. That will never sound natural to me. They're calling Apollo now the human highlight reel. Apparently he may be in line for a push. I think you and I know better than that. No goodwill with these people. Like I said, no goodwill. Apollo has a ton of talent. He should be doing more than he is. He should start racking up some wins. Problem with him, though, is the same as it's always been. Nothing has changed from the moment he first got called up. He was with Titus Worldwide all this time. Now he's not. And I'm watching him on Monday, and I just thought to myself, nothing has changed. He comes out, and he smiles. But that's all he does. He's got that big, cheesy, toothy grin. And that's it. There's nothing behind it. There's no personality. There's nothing. There's nothing else there, personality-wise. That needs to change. Or else he's going to end up getting the same kind of push that Mojo Rawley got. Remember when Mojo was getting pushed for all of 3 weeks? How'd that end up? How'd that turn out for him? That's what's going to happen to this guy. Unless he changes something up or the company does something with him. Nia Jax. Ugh, Nia Jax. Nia Jax beat Ember Moon. Again, I was watching this thinking, did I just see? I thought I just saw this match, and sure enough, the week before, we got the same freaking match. Second week in a row here. I hated this, by the way. This was just not good. Even worse, when the match was over, they had Tamina come out to fight with Nia, or to tease a fight with Nia, only to attack Ember. And her and Nia beat up Ember for a little bit before they walked off together. What did I say last week? What did I say last week? These two are not going to feud. They're going to team up. And you can see what they're doing here, too, because all over Raw, all over SmackDown, they're planting the seeds for the women's tag team tournament that they're going to be having soon. I don't know if it's weeks away, months away. It's coming. You'll have Sasha and Bayley, and you'll have the Riot Squad and the Iconics, and Asuka and Naomi, and you'll have Nia and Tamina. So they're clearly planting the seeds for that. I think that's part of why they put these two together. So now we end up with the mild Samoans on Monday Night Raw. And Nia is a heel again. Bobby Lashley beat Finn Balor again. Here's another example. Another example of a match that we have seen over and over again. And it wasn't particularly good the first time, so I didn't necessarily need to see it a second time, but this was the second or third time now I think we've seen these two go one-on-one. Is there anybody on this roster who has gone from potential hero to zero faster than Finn Balor? I'm sure there have been. I mean, we're dealing with WWE creative here. But Balor was a true, like, looked at as a top-tier guy. A lot of people did. Not everybody, I guess. Some people don't like him. Some people think he's too small. But he was certainly positioned as a top guy at one time. He was Universal Champion. He got hurt. And I would say, I guess, ever since he came back, you know, he would be featured in a big match every now and then. But he has done absolutely nothing. And now he's been reduced to teaming with Bayley in this mixed match challenge. And he's another one who comes out. He's got the cheesy smile. He's supposed to be the demon, right? He's got this demonic side that we never get to see. And instead, he just comes out on television every week, and there's nothing there. I think Finn Balor's a good wrestler, but what is he beyond, you know, just being a good wrestler? Okay, you're a good wrestler, so what? You know how many great wrestlers there are these days? Just in this company alone, let alone the indies and all the other promotions, you get numb to it after a while. You see so much good wrestling and so many great matches in NXT. And I look at this guy and I say, okay, what else is there? How do I justify if I am having a debate or an argument with somebody that Finn Balor should be in title contention or Finn Balor should be at the top of the card? You know, I don't know. I don't really have a strong argument for it right now. There's just not a whole lot there. And I'd say ever since the feud with Corbin, surprise, surprise, this guy has been completely dead in the water. Speaking of Corbin, he spent the entire show hiding from Braun Strowman before fleeing the building. Braun had, he had a run after him as Corbin jumped in his car. I guess the car just didn't leave fast enough because Braun, this was the most comical attempt at running I've ever seen. It looked like he had to intentionally slow himself down. I'm hoping that's all it was, and it wasn't a case of him having bad knees. I know there's been some rumors about that. There's also, there was a report this week that was credited to Mike Johnson of PW Insider, claiming that Braun Strowman has heat backstage, because at times he shows up late to the building, he does little things that makes management cool on him. He does not have heat backstage. Johnson shut that shit down a couple days ago. That part is just not true. You might think that he did piss people off based on the way that they've been booking him recently, but the fact is he's still a top guy on the brand. He is not being buried. You know, if he was late to some shows, that part may be true, but this idea that he has heat, he's in the doghouse, total 100% bullshit. Can you imagine how ridiculous that would even be to demote a guy or kill his push or bury him for being late to shows? Instead of just handling something like that internally behind the scenes, you know, imagine believing a report that Braun Strowman didn't win the Universal title at Crown Jewel for arriving late to TVs. When Bret Hart, who was notorious for showing up late to shows, had the kind of career that he did. Imagine if they had buried Bret Hart for that. Oh, this guy can't get to the building on time. We're going to bury him. We're not going to push this guy. He never would have been champion. He never would have become as big of a star for being late. Whatever may be going on with Braun, I doubt that that is the reason for it. Stephanie McMahon returns on Raw tomorrow night, which is an awfully enticing reason for me to keep my finger by the mute button on my remote control. She will be there to address her brother Shane stealing the World Cup at Crown Jewel in parts unknown. Speaking of Stephanie, she made some headlines this week while speaking at the Web Summit in Lisbon, Portugal. She said, 10, 20, 30 years from now, there's no reason that we, being WWE, can't be as big or bigger than Disney. And she said, now that's a tall order, especially given recent transactions. However, there's no reason why we can't get there. You have to dream big, have big, bold goals, and go after them. Look, it's nice to have goals. I have goals. You have goals. Soccer players score goals. Goals are good. But it's also important to be realistic about those goals. Stephanie is their chief brand officer. I imagine she knows a thing or two about PR and marketing. This is total PR speak. That's all this is. There is no way that she honestly believes this. And I know, is it far-fetched to think that a McMahon is delusional? Not at all. And there may be quite a bit of delusion here. But she knows what she's doing. She knows that there are stockholders who are going to see this and hear this, and that if she says it out loud, she could get other people to possibly buy into it. I don't think most people will buy into it. She was roundly mocked for it this week. I think they hear that and think that she is delusional. But she feels she has to say stuff like this. There is a far better chance that Disney buys them out than WWE ever coming close to competing with Disney on the same level, being as big or bigger than them. WWE struck a deal with Fox for SmackDown, right? For $1 billion. That was a big deal for WWE. They're getting paid, what? I've heard $250 million. I've heard $450 million on that Saudi Arabia deal. They sold their soul to the Saudi government to do a bunch of shows over the next decade to make a few $100 million. One Marvel movie will make that much and then some for Disney. Disney spent $4 billion. $4 billion that company spent to acquire Marvel, one of the smartest deals ever made. They paid $4 billion to buy Lucasfilm and the Star Wars franchise. Again, one of the smartest deals ever made. Those two deals alone, forget all of their own properties and characters, those two deals alone could probably carry them for decades to come. Now they're spending over $50 billion. I'm sure you've seen some of these stories. They're buying 20th Century Fox. WWE acquires video libraries. Disney acquires giant corporations. It's like WWE has salad for dinner, and Disney eats bison every night. An actual bison. Disney's starting their own video streaming service later next year. Some people are calling it's going to be a Netflix killer. I wouldn't go that far. But they're going to compete with Netflix. You know how many subscribers Netflix has? 117 million. Even if Disney does half that, I guarantee you they'll do more. But even if they did half that number, if they did a quarter of that number, the WWE Network has around 2 million subscribers. In 5 years now that the WWE Network has been around, almost 5 years, in February it'll be 5 years, they've racked up 2 million subscribers. And for them, that's good. That's very good. Now, that number is probably less if we're talking about paid subscribers, because I think that number includes paid and people on the free trial. You think it's going to take Disney 5 years to get 2 million subscribers for their streaming service with all the content that they have? Believe me, it's going to take a lot more than 20 to 30 years to play catch-up with a company like Disney. It's good to be ambitious. And I know there's been a lot of delusional people in the wrestling business. Delusional Dixie may have been my favorite. But to say that there's no reason you can't be as big or bigger than Disney, there's no way she believes that. Like I said, it's all PR spin. And she's rightfully getting laughed at for it. I mean, one company produced The Lion King. The other produced The Marine Six. Enough said. SmackDown Live was also from Manchester, England this week. We had about 2,200 votes in the Twitter poll, 37% thumbs up, only 5% thumbs down, and 58% said they did not watch. This was Election Day here in the States, so I'm sure a lot of that 58%, they were busy watching the election returns like I was. The best in the world, Shane McMahon, got loud boos when he was introduced by Paige at the beginning of the show. It does not look like this Shane heel turn is happening, at least not yet. He didn't come out and really heel it up. He just came out and said, look, I know I'm not the best in the world. I was just acting on instinct, you know, and I hijacked the World Cup, basically, at Crown Jewel, and I beat Dolph Ziggler. I did it for SmackDown. I did it for Team Blue. And he announced that Daniel Bryan would be the team captain for the SmackDown team in the men's match at Survivor Series. Miz came out, he wasn't happy with that, and so Shane ended up making him the co-captain. So now Bryan and Miz, hated rivals, now must work together. They got to pick team members throughout the entire show. They were being nice to each other, for the most part, until the end anyway. Bryan said that this was weird, which it was, seeing the two of them be nice to one another. Miz picked Shane as their first partner. Remember when Roman Reigns nearly murdered Shane McMahon with a spear in the Survivor Series match a few years back? This would be the third year in a row that Shane McMahon will be taking part in one of these Survivor Series elimination matches. Becky Lynch and Nikki Cross. There's a match I don't think a lot of people expected here on this show. Nikki Cross made a surprise return. Well, not return, I guess. It would be her main roster debut with Sanity. Now, Sanity is a group that I had forgotten even existed. I couldn't even tell you before this week the last time I saw them on SmackDown. But there was Sanity interrupting Becky, and out came Nikki, and the rest of the members retreated to the back. Nikki came down to the ring, and they talked for about a minute, and then they had a match. Now, I don't know if this is a full-time call-up for Nikki Cross. I'm not ready to call it that because it could just be something they did because they were in the UK and they wanted to give Becky a win, which they did. Nikki at least has one match, we know that, left in NXT. They've already set that match up with Candice LeRae. I don't know when that's going to take place, but I'm sure that match is going to happen. So she's not done yet with NXT, based on what's been going on there. I just don't know what else there is left for her to do in NXT. You know, once that angle runs its course, which now that Aleister Black is back, it seems like it has run its course. I'm not a fan of her losing in her first match here, but she lost to the champ. So there's no shame in that. But if you recall, the other members of Sanity also lost in their television debut. And they've barely been seen since. So it's not like, well, you know, yeah, she lost, and it's not a big deal. She lost to Becky Lynch. She lost to the best female performer right now in the company on the main roster, the hottest one anyway, the hottest act. And so there's no shame in that. Yeah, but there's a pattern here. They've done this with other people where they debut and they lose. Lucha Underground does this too, but Lucha Underground is, that's just a completely different beast altogether. Just the whole nature of that show is completely over the top, and I actually have faith in the writers on that show. So that's different. But in WWE, they've done this before where people debut, they lose in their first match. Whatever happened to debuting and facing some scrub and being able to show off your moveset and establish your personality for a few weeks before you sort of branch off into actual legitimate competition? They don't really do that much anymore. Every now and then, somebody like Braun or Ryback, you know, this is going back many years now, but, you know, they had Ryback stacking up jobbers week after week for months. And look what happened to him. He got over. He got over. What a shock. Now, you can't do that with everybody. Not everybody is going to debut and look as dominant as Braun Strowman or Ryback. But this idea that you debut and you lose in your first match, because of the pattern, that's what I think sucks. Her losing here in this match didn't bother me so much. But you look at Sanity, and you wonder, is the same fate what lies ahead for Nikki Cross? I would hate for Nikki to be called up, only to vanish, just like the rest of them. And I was never a big fan of Sanity to begin with. If you go back and you listen to my old NXT reviews, I just wasn't a fan. You know, Eric Young, who cares? Yeah, he's a good wrestler, but even in Impact, when I was watching consistently, Eric Young never did anything for me. I don't really care about Eric Young. Who cares? Who cares? So I was never a big Sanity fan, but I would at least give them a chance. You call them up. Why would you call them up and just cut their legs off as soon as they get called up? Rey Mysterio beat Andrade Cien Almas. No Zelina Vega in Andrade's corner. She may have suffered a concussion at Evolution. That's the fear. Anyway, when she got tossed out of the Battle Royal by Nia Jax, and so they're keeping her out as a precaution. A good match here, just a taste of what I'm sure they could do if they had more than 8 minutes to have a match. Almas lost, but he's always just one solid program away with a bigger name from being a real player on this show. Maybe it's with Mysterio. It doesn't look that way because Randy Orton came out and RKO'd Rey, and it looks like they're setting something up with him and Rey. So I don't think it'll be Mysterio. Maybe it'll be with Daniel Bryan. I wouldn't mind a Daniel Bryan Cien Almas program coming out of Survivor Series. But he needs something like that because right now it just feels like he's there. He exists. And maybe he's waiting his turn. But you wait too long, and again, that ship may sail, and it's going to be hard to get people to care about this guy. You want him to start doing more things like this. Yeah, again, he lost to Mysterio here, but it was a competitive match. You know, he looked impressive. He's got that going for him. I think he'll win people over with his matches. I think that Cien Almas, even with not the best booking in the world, can do well. Because here's a guy, when I first saw him in NXT, I knew of his history, La Sombra, former, you know, IWGP Intercontinental Champion, big star down in Mexico. I had heard about him, I had seen some of his matches online, wasn't overly familiar with him. All I saw when he debuted, he had the frickin' top hat and the suspenders. He looked like something out of Chippendales. I said, I can't take this guy seriously. What is he wearing? I can't, you know, and there was nothing about him that was special. He would come out, they would play his music, and I can remember, like, the crowd would sort of die when he would come out. There just was no excitement there. And then one day, they put him with Zelina Vega, he ditched the suspenders, he ditched the hat, he turned heel, and it was like a complete 180. It was like a different person altogether, and he went on to have some of the best matches in the history of the NXT brand. And him and Zelina together make for a great combo. So now they're on the main roster. I think there's a lot of potential there. But he's got to be doing stuff. You've got to be able to put him in there with people that... Yeah, you know, like a Daniel Bryan is the perfect example. They're not doing anything right now with Daniel Bryan. As far as like a big singles program. The thing with Miz ran its course. Now they're going into Survivor Series. And the question is, who's he going to feud with coming out of Survivor Series? You know, Joe? You could feud with Joe, I guess. I already kind of feel like it's been there, done that in a way. But yeah, I guess you could do that. Bryan and Orton, we've seen that before. I have no interest in seeing that again. Bryan and Almas. Or Bryan and Nakamura. I think that's probably the most likely scenario. He'll feud for the U.S. title with Shinsuke. But other than Shinsuke, Almas is the one to me who makes the most sense. So I hope they do it. Paige was on the show. She was announcing the women's team at Survivor Series. She named Naomi, Carmella, Sonya Deville, Asuka, and Charlotte as the team members. Charlotte did not come out. There's something going on with her. I'm telling you. I said this a few weeks ago. She's going to factor into the finish of that Becky Lynch-Ronda Rousey match in some way. So she didn't come out here. Mandy Rose, though, she came out, and she was on the mic cutting a promo on all the women in the ring, and not for nothing. I sure thought she did a hell of a job here. You know, Mandy is somebody who I think could be... Again, I don't want to compare her to Trish Stratus because she kind of looks like Trish in a way, a young Trish, blonde and, you know, decent enough wrestler. But over time, Trish got better and so will Mandy. I think she will. I think she'll... I don't want to compare her to Trish because that's not fair to her. But she has the potential. When I say that, what I mean is that she has the potential to get even better, and I think she could become a real player in the women's division. She's not embarrassing when she's out there. She doesn't embarrass herself in the ring. There are women who have no business being in the ring. I said for years, Rosa Mendez. Rosa Mendez had no business being in the ring. Rosa Mendez had a lot of friends backstage in the company, and she was on Total Divas, and people seemed to like her. Great. Great. Gandhi was a good guy. I don't want to see Gandhi wrestle. He'd be fucking terrible. Just because you're a nice person doesn't mean that you should be in the ring wrestling. Rosa Mendez had 10 years on that roster, and in 10 years, I would argue, she actually regressed and somehow got worse. There are just some people who don't belong in the ring. So, and I'll take Dana Brooke. Dana Brooke has gotten better, I would say a little bit better, than how she used to be. But Dana Brooke is probably an example of somebody who would be a lot better off like she was doing with Titus Worldwide, being some sort of valet or a manager. And there's nothing wrong with that. There are some guys who, frankly, are not very good over the years who would have, I think, thrived in a managerial position. But we went through this period where Vince McMahon doesn't like managers. That's too old school wrestling. We're not going to have managers. Imagine all the people who had, you know, the ability to speak, who probably could have done really well as a mouthpiece or a manager for somebody, who got passed over because Vince was on one of his kicks. Now, of course, all of a sudden he loves managers, right? Leo Rush is a manager now. We have Zelina Vega as a manager. Paul Heyman, of course, is with Brock, and there's probably other examples. But Mandy, I think, is... I would not put her in that category. She is not an embarrassment. She's pretty good. And on the microphone, she was great. So now you have somebody who can wrestle. She's got an athletic background. She can talk, and she looks friggin' amazing. There's star potential all over this woman. So she's out there, you know, tearing down Carmella and Asuka and insulting them. Why is Sonya in this match? You know, when I eliminated her from the Battle Royal at Evolution, which is a good point, by the way. And so in the end, they beat her down. Naomi went after her. She made a comment about Naomi. Naomi beat her up, and she had to be separated from Sonya. So we'll see. We'll see where they go with Mandy Rose. The main event was Samoa Joe beating Jeff Hardy to earn the final spot on the Men's Survivor Series team. They had Bryan and Miz out there doing commentary for the match. We had the Twist of Fate and a Swanton attempt by Jeff, but Joe got the knees up, locked on the Coquina clutch for the win. So Joe avenges that brief match that he had, that loss, to qualify for the World Cup at Crown Jewel. And that's when they wrote him off television for a few weeks, and supposedly he was dealing with some sort of injury. So he vanquishes Jeff Hardy here and gets a win. After the match, Joe got up in Brian's face outside the ring. Brian went after him. He put him in the yes lock. Miz tried to break it up. Then Brian and Miz started fighting. Shane ran out. Brian didn't see. He didn't know who it was. He shoved him down. So a lot of dissension in the ranks here of Team SmackDown. And at Survivor Series, it looks to be Daniel Bryan, The Miz, Rey Mysterio, Samoa Joe, and Shane McMahon. That is the rumored team. That is the completed rumored team. I say rumored. I don't know if that match with Almas was a qualifying match or not. So I don't know if Rey is officially on the team or not. But that is the team for the Blue Brand at Survivor Series. And also added to the Survivor Series card, and this piqued my interest, Buddy Murphy defends the Cruiserweight Championship against Mustafa Ali. And, I'm sure it'll be the Survivor Series kickoff match, I'm sure. But that could be an incredible match if they give those guys time. I would put that match up against any match on the NXT TakeOver card the night before. And that TakeOver card looks incredible. And these two guys could go out there the next night and have that kind of match and just tear the house down.
This is the one, the only hot dog man from Hot Dog Land. And you are listening to the Solid Monster Sound.
We had a couple of really good matches that highlighted this week's NXT episode. Heavy Machinery had what I think was their best NXT match to date, beating the Forgotten Sons, Steve Cutler and Wesley Snipes. They, of course, had Jackson Ricker in their corner. I really like this match. I like this match a lot. Cutler and Blake used the old Power and Glory finish at one point that Paul Roma and Hercules used back in the day, only these guys didn't do it nearly as well. The old superplex followed by the big splash out of the other corner. Nice little flurry of action here at the end with Otis. Gotta love Otis. He propelled Cutler up into the air. He caught him on the way down for a power slam and the pin. Nice trip, bad landing. I think Otis and Tucker are probably going to end up like Cass and Enzo on this show. Cass and Enzo were a very popular team who somehow never won the NXT Tag Team Championships, but they were a fun act together. And I think these guys are going to end up falling into the same category. Otis is clearly the more charismatic of the two, but unlike the Street Profits, who I think when the time is right, Montez Ford is going to break away and be much better off for doing so and being away from Angelo Dawkins, these two guys, I think, are better off sticking together and playing off one another. Like, Tucker Knight by himself, dead in the water. Otis by himself, I think Otis has potential, but I think Otis plays off of someone else. I think he plays off of Tucker, you know, very nicely. And I'm still digging their act. I think they're very entertaining. And like I said, this match impressed me. I thought this was a good match. Dakota Kai beat Tainara Conchi with the Chiropractor, which is a very clever name, I must say, for her finish. Her finish looks great. It's that modified Code Red. It's basically a backstabber to the back of the person's head. It looks brutal. So she beat Conchi with that. Bianca Belair interrupted a Mia Yim promo backstage. Mia Yim was doing an interview, and Bianca once again mentioned the fact that she was undefeated. Did I say that right? Undefeated. Mia called herself the HBIC. I thought she said HSBC at first. I was like, what? What'd she say? She called herself the HBIC. She is not a bank. And the HBIC stands apparently for Head Baddie in Charge. Now, of course, if this were a different time and place, she would be the head bitch in charge, but here she's the head baddie, which does not sound nearly as cool. It's like, yes, I am the notorious PIP, podcaster in pain, when I watch Raw every Monday night. That's going to be my new nickname going forward. Johnny Gargano broke his silence with a taped selfie promo from the outdoor, I guess it was the parking lot area at Full Sail, where he attacked Aleister Black. And he basically said that he did what he did because he wanted to be the man to beat Tommaso Ciampa at that TakeOver show, that it was supposed to be a triple threat. Black got attacked. It turned into a singles match. He wanted to be the guy to beat Ciampa. Of course, he still could not beat Tommaso Ciampa one-on-one, even without Aleister Black in the picture, which means he painted a bullseye on his own ass for no reason. He said he doesn't view himself as the bad guy. He's still the same old Johnny Wrestling. He just has to fight dirty sometimes, just like everybody else. Lars Sullivan beat the Velveteen Dream when Tommaso Ciampa caused the distraction that led to Dream's downfall. I didn't know how Dream would work with Lars, but this turned out to be a pretty good little match here. When Dream took, he took a Harley Race bump out of the over-the-top rope in the corner. And when I saw that, I grabbed my pec. I said, this is not the week for that. Dream was headed up top of the Purple Rain elbow drop when Ciampa ran down. Dream opted to instead jump on him on the outside. And as soon as he rolled himself back into the ring, Sullivan caught him with the freak accident and pinned him. Ciampa attacked Dream when the match was over. Dream fought back, went up top for the elbow. Referees poured in. They said, no elbow. And he climbed back down, he went to go leave, and then all of a sudden he rushed back down to the ring, he climbed up top, hit the elbow anyway, and he posed with the NXT Championship. I don't think he's winning it. I think it's still a little early to take it off Ciampa. I think it's very early to take it off Ciampa. I don't think Dream would have any issues if they wanted to put the title on him, but in terms of taking it off of Tommaso, I think it's too soon to do that. But I'm looking forward to that match, and now that you know one of my predictions, clearly, which is that Tommaso Ciampa is going to retain next weekend at TakeOver, let's get into the rest of the predictions, because there is a TakeOver show, TakeOver War Games, and we'll save the Survivor Series predictions for next week, or maybe I'll record them later in the week and put them up on YouTube, we'll see. But here are your NXT TakeOver War Games predictions for the show coming up this Saturday, the 17th, from the Staples Center in Los Angeles. It's another one of these double TakeOver WWE pay-per-view combo weekends. Yes, there is another pay-per-view already coming up next Sunday. Last year's War Games show was excellent. It was the first ever War Games match under the WWE banner. And they changed some of the rules around, and there was no top on the cage. There were some differences, but by and large, I loved it. I thought it was great, and I was begging for War Games to come back for years, and they finally brought it back. So what's there to be upset about? Plus, you had Andrade Cien Almas winning the NXT Championship from Drew McIntyre. Excellent match. That was the match where, unfortunately, at the very end, on the very last move of the match, the draping DDT off the top rope, Drew hurt himself, and he was out for many months. But that was a great match, and then they had another excellent match, Aleister Black beating the Velveteen Dream, and then finally saying Dream's name when the match was over. I loved everything about the build-up to that match. I loved the match itself. I thought it was great. I hope they get to revisit it one day. On last year's show, Cassius Ohno was slotted with Lars Sullivan, the veteran taking on the new guy, and Ohno lost. Well, here we are again 1 year later, and Ohno finds himself in a very similar role of the veteran player against the new guys. And I should say, this has not yet been added to the card as I am sitting here recording this. But I assume that we are either going to get Cassius Ohno against Keith Lee, or Cassius Ohno against Matt Riddle. I figure it's probably Ohno against Riddle, and if so, my prediction is that Riddle wins. And then gets attacked by Ohno when the match is over, and maybe Keith Lee comes out to make the save. I could see things going down like that. Ohno versus Riddle has already been announced, but not for this show. It's been announced for the WrestleMania 35 on-sale party that they're doing at MetLife Stadium coming up this Thursday. So they're actually wrestling on that show at MetLife. This is, I guess, a couple days before TakeOver. For TakeOver, though, it's not yet official. Maybe they'll shoot an angle. Maybe they're going to shoot an angle at the MetLife Stadium thing on Thursday, and I don't know. We'll see. Maybe that's their plan here. But as I am sitting here on November 11th recording this, this is not yet official for the TakeOver card. Shayna Baszler will defend her NXT Women's Championship. She'll do so in a 2-out-of-3 falls match against Kairi Sane. Of course, Shayna now has her fellow horsewomen in her corner, Marina Shafir and Jessamyn Duke. I'm sure they'll be out there with her. I cannot see her losing the championship so soon after winning it back. And so I guess if I had to make a prediction on the falls, like who wins the first fall, who wins the second fall, I would say that it probably follows the traditional format where Kyrie maybe picks up a fluke win in the first fall. Actually, I take that back. Shayna wins the first fall. And then Kyrie wins the second fall. Shayna wins the third. But either way, my prediction is that Shayna retains. We have Aleister Black taking on Johnny Gargano. Or as someone on Twitter very accurately put it, one side of Hot Topic against the other side of Hot Topic. This should be a fantastic match. I think, if nothing else, I don't know storyline-wise where they're going to go with this, if Candice LeRae may get involved, if Nikki Cross may be there and she may get involved. This could go any number of ways, but I think Johnny Gargano gets the win. I think he... Aleister Black does not need to win this match. Johnny Gargano, I feel like, for the character he's portraying right now, he needs to win this match. So I've got him as my pick. And then the main event, you already know, my pick is Tommaso Ciampa to retain the championship against the Velveteen Dream. Also, should be a great match. It'll be another test. You know, this is the biggest match of his NXT career to date. Dream is very good. Ciampa's great. I see no reason why this match can't be fantastic. And so we'll see how that ends up. We have also, now, that's not the main event. That's the main event for the championship. The actual main event, of course, is the War Games match itself. And that's going to pit the Undisputed Era, Adam Cole, Bobby Fish, Kyle O'Reilly, and Roderick Strong. 4-on-4 against the team of Ricochet, Rick O'Shea, Pete Dunne, and the War Raiders. They're having a singles match on TV this week with one member from each team. And whoever wins, that person's team will get the man advantage in War Games. The heels should get the man advantage. It just builds more drama that way. To me, it doesn't make any sense if you have the babyface get the advantage here. That's kind of ass backwards. You couldn't really do that last year because you had three teams instead of two. This year, though, you can. I don't see the Undisputed Era winning back-to-back War Games matches. Plus, if my other predictions are right, it may be a very heel-heavy show in terms of wins. So I'm going to pick the babyfaces to win here. And that's your takeover card. I am very much looking forward to that show. I'm not going to shit on Survivor Series, because honestly, when you look at the Survivor Series card, the Survivor Series card looks pretty strong too. So I think there's going to be some nice competition next weekend between these two shows, but it's hard to bet against these takeover shows because they routinely blow the main roster out of the water. And I don't know that this will be any different, but it should be a fun weekend. Mako Satomura, who is my MVP of this year's Mae Young Classic, and who made it all the way to the semifinals before losing to Toni Storm, told Yahoo Japan this week that she intends to return to WWE in 2019. She said that she was at the Evolution pay-per-view out there in the crowd, and that the fans were so noisy, she just wanted to stand in that ring. She feels so strongly that she just cannot stay in Japan. She said the match between Charlotte and Becky Lynch made her whole body tremble. She said that she left. So now, all you guys out there, if you ever date somebody, a female who is a big wrestling fan, big NXT fan, you want to get her all hot and bothered, you want to get her in the mood, you want to get her body to tremble, now you know what to do. You pop in a, I was going to say pop in a tape like I'm fucking 50 years old here. You log on to your WWE Network thing, you crank up that Becky and Charlotte match, and you put that on TV in the background, you're going to have yourself a good night. You take that advice right there from Mako Satomura. She said that she left with an open door invite to return, and she can never come in full time, she said, because she runs her own promotion in Japan. She also works with a couple of different UK promotions, which I was not aware of. Given that she's already working in the UK, I think NXT UK would be a natural place to have her come in next year and wrestle some of the ladies there. She can come in and be a special attraction, not unlike, you know, when they brought Jushin Thunder Liger in that one time to NXT and he worked a match with Tyler Breeze. She could do the same thing for them. She could work a few matches during the year. And again, if she's spending a lot of time in the UK, if they can time it with their tapings, I don't see any reason why she can't wrestle on the NXT UK brand. So I hope she does come back. She's awesome. Ultima Lucha 4, Part 2 of Lucha Underground. This may have been the final episode of Lucha Underground. Not just of the season, but the final episode ever. Which means this could be my final Lucha Underground review. And if it was the last episode, they went out with a bang. A lot of crazy twists and turns, storyline-wise, a lot of violent, very violent, bloody matches. And really only one thing I didn't like, and that has to do with what they did with the Lucha Underground Championship. So I'm sure some of you can see where I'm going with this. But let's go through this show here, and then I'll have some other news about Lucha Underground and a comment or two at the end. Right off the bat on this show, we got a backstage segment where Johnny Mundo tells Taya very casually, hey, if I happen to get sacrificed to the gods tonight in his match with Matanza, just know that I love you. Like he's going off to buy milk. If I happen to get sacrificed on my way to buy milk here, know that I love you. Then Johnny leaves and Taya ends up getting possessed by the creepy doll that she stole from Ricky Mundo. And this was just the first segment. We had Phoenix taking on Dragon Azteca Jr. 2 out of 3 falls match. I feel like there's been a lot of those lately. They push that Phoenix is undefeated at Ultima Lucha. He's like a Spanish Undertaker. Undertaker was undefeated at WrestleMania. Ultima Lucha is like their WrestleMania, and Phoenix is also undefeated. Undertaker wrestled in casket matches, so has Phoenix. They call Undertaker the dead man. Phoenix was literally a dead man on this show, who then got brought back to life. Maybe in 30 years, Phoenix and his brother will be still wrestling in main events. And his brother's mask will go flying off his head too. This match felt like the victim of editing to me. Because these falls were going way too fast. They were going way quicker than they should have been. Phoenix won the first fall in just 2 minutes. With the Phoenix driver. 2 minutes after that, Azteca tied it up at one fall apiece with a satellite DDT, one of my favorite moves to watch in all of wrestling. So in less than 5 minutes, it turned into a regular match, which always begs the question, why even bother with the 2 out of 3 fall stipulation? How can you build drama if one guy wins the first fall in 2 minutes, the other guy wins the next fall in 2 minutes, and now it's like, oh, it comes down to the third fall. No, it's just a regular match now. WWE does that a lot, and it always bugs the shit out of me when they do that, because it just renders the stipulation completely pointless. So I hope that these falls actually were longer live, and it was just a case of El Rey, you know, editing the thing down. Otherwise, I just don't get what the point of watching guys who ordinarily, it takes so much punishment to put them. That's the other thing that bothers me about this. It's like, we see so many matches in Lucha Underground and other promotions and indie promotions. You throw everything in the kitchen sink at these guys. And Phoenix is a big name. We've seen him in big matches before. He always kicks out. He always gets a shoulder up. 15, 20, 25 minutes later, some kind of crazy move. And finally, they get beaten down. And here the guy gets pinned in 2 minutes. Off one move. It's not realistic. I mean, there's really nothing about Lucha Underground that's realistic, I guess. But you know what I'm saying? Like, it's just, again, one of those minor things. It is a minor thing, but it just bugs the shit out of me. It's like Seth Rollins with the superplex into the Falcon Arrow. Beautiful move. Gets a great reaction all the time. Pretty much kills the superplex dead for everybody else who does it. When you just pop up from it like it didn't mean anything at all. It's just one of those things. Anyway, this is where Antonio Cueto came out. So this actually ended up not being just a regular match in the end. He came out, and he made the third and final fall. Falls count anywhere. And Azteca hit another satellite DDT on Phoenix, this time on the floor. Yet somehow, this time, he couldn't beat him with it. Just saying. Doesn't make a whole lot of sense. But there was a Hurricanrana off the guardrail into the stands. Or in the stands, rather, down through a table for a near fall. Just tons of crazy spots here in this match. They did another table spot where Azteca was laid across a table that was set up outside the ring. And Phoenix hit a giant senton from the top rope down onto the table, but the table did not break. I am the table. Okay, the table did not break. Matt Stryker, on commentary, then says this. He says that it would have been better for the table to break because it actually makes it easier on the person who's laid out on the table. He is explaining to the audience why it would actually be better, why you would want to be put through the table, because it won't hurt as much, thus killing every future table spot on this show. Now, what he said may well be true, but why, oh why, would you say that out loud on TV? That was so stupid. As Tekka hit a top rope cradle, threw a table in the ring, but Phoenix kicked out. Well, of course he did. Of course he kicked out. Matt Stryker just got done telling us that it hurts a lot less when the table breaks. Didn't you hear? Of course he kicked out. As Tekka went to hit Phoenix with a chair, but Melissa Santos got up on the apron. She begged him not to do it. She still has feelings for Phoenix. This distraction was enough, though, for Phoenix to come back and hit the Phoenix driver for the win. So, yet again, here's another case of the woman distracting the guy and costing him the match. Melissa was devastated by all of this. She ran off. We never heard from her again for the rest of the show. This was the first of many crazy matches here on this two-hour finale. So because Melissa bailed, we needed a new ring announcer. And nobody called me. I wasn't available. So they had Antonio Cueto come out and introduce us to their newest signee, Shaul Guerrero, who, of course, is the daughter of Eddie and Vicky Guerrero, Aiden English's better half. She had been in FCW for a while, but ended up in rehab. She had an eating disorder. She came back to NXT. She got released. So she didn't have a very long run there. Only this year, really, has she gotten back into the business. I have not heard hardly anything about her in the last 3 or 4 years. So now she's getting back into the wrestling business, and I thought she carried herself great here. She did a fine job on the ring announcing part for the rest of the night. Famous B, though, Famous B, he came out and he handed her one of his business cards and basically tried to kick her to the curb, told her to leave, and he would take over. And she did her mother's excuse me line, which people popped for, and then she called him Famous Bitch. That was awesome. Now we know what the B stands for in Famous B. So this brought out Chavo Guerrero, and my favorite person in the world. Shaul hit her dad's Three Amigos on Famous Bitch, and then Chavo hit the Frog Splash to end the segment. This got over huge with the live crowd. It got over huge with me, too. I had a lot of fun watching this. I thought this was a fun segment. We had Mil Muertes against The Mac in a death match. First thing that Mil does is wheel out a giant casket with the words death match on it. In case you didn't know what kind of match this was, now you know. There was a second casket that got introduced into this match. Yeah, I think it's appropriate, given how many people have died on this show this season, that they would have a bunch of caskets just sort of laying around. You never know when you may need one. The body count has been high this season. So the Mac opened up one of the caskets, and inside he found that it was filled with all sorts of goodies, including an axe and an ice pick. If Jason Voorhees and Michael Myers ever had a death match, I imagine it would resemble something like this. So Mil grabbed the axe, because who the fuck wouldn't, right? That'd be the first thing I would go for. He grabbed the axe, he tried to kill the Mac with it, but Mac took it away from him. Mil hit a spear, and with Mac down, then he reached for the ice pick, and he did use the ice pick on Mac, stabbed him in the head with it. Mac started bleeding all over the place. What do you do after being stabbed in the head with an ice pick? Well, you hit a coast-to-coast in the corner, that's what you do. And Mac only got a near fall out of it. Both guys are bleeding. Mac hits a stunner. Muertes does not go down. He hits a second stunner. Still won't go down. Finally, Mac grabs a brick. And he smashes it over Mil's skull. Mac then flips him the double bird and screams, "Go to hell, you motherfucker!" Before hitting a third and final stunner for the win. See, that's something that Stone Cold should have done in one of his matches. Double bird, go to hell, motherfucker. Kick, wham, stunner. That would have been a great finish. Mac rolls him into one of the caskets. It wasn't a casket match. The match is already over. But he rolls him into one of the caskets outside the ring. He pops open a couple of what Matt Stryker called Mac-wisers. Ugh. He had a banner night on commentary, you could tell. Johnny Mundo and Matanza. In a sacrifice to the gods match, Antonio Cueto was not happy that Johnny had possession of the Nintendo Power Glove Gauntlet. Matanza came out, he was wearing some kind of, honestly, it was a pretty badass looking headdress, I guess. He had like this half skull mask covering his face. It looked pretty cool. But I like skulls, so I mean, that's, you know, I'm not hard to please when it comes to that kind of stuff. Like, if I ever got a tattoo, which I will never do, but if I ever did, it would be some kind of skull. Love skulls. They basically were battling for possession of the gauntlet at the beginning of this match here. Johnny could not get the glove on his hand. He was trying to, because if he got it on his hand, he would have mystical, magical, godlike powers. And Matanza stopped him, and Matanza grabbed the glove. Now, Matanza did not put the glove on himself. He grabbed it, and he chucked it. He chucked it up two stories up into the balcony. Well, that wouldn't stop Johnny Mundo. He climbed up after it. Matanza followed suit. Johnny was up there doing fucking parkour. He was jumping from one platform to another to try to retrieve the gauntlet. Finally, he got it. Matanza, though, was standing right behind him when Johnny picked up the glove. Didn't realize Matanza had followed him all the way up top. And Matanza chokeslammed Johnny through the roof of the top platform that they were on. And so at that point, they made it out like, well, this match is over. Matanza started to climb back down. All of a sudden, Johnny reemerges with the gauntlet on his hand, full of new magical powers from the gods. Too bad he couldn't just wave his hand. 90 minutes less of Monday Night Raw. Whoosh! Apparently you can't use the glove for that. Matanza hit the Wrath of the Gods. Mundo became the first person ever to kick out of the Wrath of the Gods slam. He punched Matanza a whole bunch of times with the glove, and finally hit him with a Superman punch with the gauntlet, and he got the pin. Backstage, Johnny runs into Aerostar, who warned him that even though he may feel great now, you've got to take that gauntlet off, Johnny. Bad things are going to happen. It's going to take over your soul. So Johnny thinks about it, and he just hands it over. And he says, I'm going to go find Taya. Okay. Pentagon Dark against Marty the Moth Martinez in a Cero Miedo match for the Lucha Underground Championship. Marty got busted wide open in the opening, I'd say, minute or two of this match. I mean, when I say he was busted open, I'm not even doing it justice. This guy was covered in blood. This was in the ballpark of Eddie Guerrero at Judgment Day. Or when Vince McMahon got busted open in the first few minutes of his Survivor Series. I think it was a Buried Alive match with Vince McMahon and The Undertaker back in 2003. Vince got busted open super early and was leaking like a faucet in that match. It was fucking disgusting. This was on that level. Marty pulled out a lunchbox from underneath the ring and grabbed a fork that he used to cut Pentagon open. So we got a double juice match here. Somewhere a nice tingle has gone up the leg of Abdullah the Butcher. Or maybe that's just the hepatitis, I don't know. Marty put a trash can over Pentagon's head while he was hanging upside down in the corner in the Tree of Woe, and he grabbed a barbed wire baseball bat like he's Negan, and he starts whacking off with it on the garbage can. He went to hit Pentagon with the bat. Pentagon ducked, and Marty hit the top rope with the bat. The bat then ricocheted back into his own face. And Pentagon put Marty through, I just like saying it that way. I say it because I know it pisses some people off. They say, like, why do you say it that way? Well, who is Rick O'Shea? I said, I don't know, that's how you say it. Rick O'Shea'd back into his face. So Pentagon put Marty through a pane of glass outside the ring, which made me wince for all the obvious reasons. Pentagon then set up six chairs in the ring, gave Marty a package pile driver through the chairs, and pinned him back. So at this point, he wins the Lucha Underground Championship, right? The match is over. He gave him the package pile driver, this huge spot. He pinned him. We have a new champion. And it was a sickening match in every possible way. So you either love this match or you absolutely hated this match. But just an absolute war between these two men, right? Exactly the kind of match you would expect from Pentagon. And also, Marty, I think, deserves a lot of credit, too. He took a lot of abuse here. So Pentagon goes to break his arm when the match is over, and now Reclusa runs out to make the save. Like, where the hell was she during the match? So out comes Reclusa to make the save. Vampiro suddenly gets up from the announce desk and goes to chase her off. And as soon as he got up from the announce desk, I knew instantly that Pentagon was fucked. Nothing good can come from Vampiro being involved. The only thing that surprised me about this was the fact that he didn't wait for his entrance music to start playing before he ran in. So Vampiro grabs the Lucha Underground Championship. He hands it to Pentagon. These two, if you remember, had the first Cerro Miedo match on Lucha Underground a few seasons back. Anyway, Vampiro then kicks Pentagon in the dick, of course. Then Pentagon kicks Vampiro in the dick, and they start brawling when all of a sudden a mystery man shows up. A mystery luchador appears, a wild luchador appears, clad in a black mask and a black outfit, and he hits Pentagon with a chair. Vampiro then bowed down to this man. He called him his master, which was comical because this guy looked like a cruiserweight out there compared to Vampiro. And the mystery man then climbs up. They bring Pentagon outside. The mystery man climbs up into the balcony of the building. And he hits a shooting star press onto Pentagon. I love how athletic these gods are. And they put Pentagon back in the ring, and then this guy hits a corkscrew shooting star. The mystery man, by the way, is Australian Suicide, who wrestles in AAA. He had a hexagon. If you look, he's a little tiny hexagon on his mask. And according to Lucha Blog, Lucha Underground has filed a trademark for the name Hexagon Black. So if this show ever does come back, that's what this guy's going to be called. So we're going to have a pentagon fighting a hexagon. And Brock Lesnar will be fighting in an octagon. And Impact got moved to 10 p.m. because their viewers are almost all gone. So, now I kid Impact. They have a better product now. It's just, unfortunately for them, fewer and fewer people are tuning in. It's a very real problem that they have right now. So Pentagon is laid out. And out comes Jake Strong. And he has got his Gift of the Gods championship with him, and he says that he's cashing in, although when he said that, you could hear a change in his voice, like there's a god inside of him showing through. This is his human form, but it's actually one of the gods, the evil gods. It's a good thing this guy plays a supernatural character on this show, because at least I can rationalize him winning the championship here, which is exactly what happened, by the way. He put Pentagon in the ankle lock, and he snapped Pentagon's ankle a whole bunch of times. Pentagon refused to submit. The referee threw the match away. He stopped the match and awarded the championship to Jake Strong. My issue is that at the end of the day, this season, quite possibly the final season, the final episode ever of Lucha Underground, ends with Jack Swagger as the Lucha Underground champion. There is something very wrong with that. You know, I'm old enough to remember the first time that Swagger cashed in to win a world title. That didn't turn out too well. I saw it once. I don't need to see it again. So I was not happy with that being the finish and that person being chosen for that finish. Look, they certainly portrayed him this season to be stronger than WWE ever portrayed him. But I just don't see him as being a good fit on this show. Not an interesting one, anyway. I just don't think he's a good fit. Now he's the champion. He's the last face that we see standing here at the end of possibly the final episode. I didn't like it. They did wash the bad taste out of my mouth, though, with their closing montage. These are always well done. There is no other promotion or wrestling television show in the world, because it's not really a promotion, but there's no other wrestling television show in the world that does these segments as good as Lucha Underground does. Not WWE, not anybody. And in this montage, we start out, we see King Cuerno and Dragon Azteca Jr. and Aerostar, they're standing together. And Cuerno thinks that that gauntlet needs to be hidden again. We gotta hide the gauntlet. And Dragon Azteca says, well, he takes it, he mentions that there is a she who needs to use it. That she turned out to be Black Lotus, who we haven't seen all season. I don't remember the last time I saw her. I'm pretty sure we haven't seen her one time this season until now. She confronts Matanza and tells him she knows it was him who killed her parents and not Dragon Azteca. and she uses the gauntlet to do her best Kano from Mortal Kombat impersonation, and she rips Matanza's heart right out of his chest. And here you thought we were going to get out of this last episode without somebody getting murdered. You thought wrong. She gives the gauntlet back to Dragon. At least they wrapped up that story arc. Like, I could sit here and say, well, she came out of nowhere. We didn't see her all season. All of a sudden, she's back. But they tied up that storyline, so that's cool. So Dragon has the glove back, and he's in the back somewhere. And we see Swagger shows up, and he kicks his ass, breaks his ankle, and takes the glove. He says, this belongs to us. Meanwhile, Johnny, elsewhere, backstage, Johnny finds Taya, tells her that he's ready for their honeymoon now that he has vanquished Matanza. He has avenged what he did to them at their wedding. Taya, though, has been possessed by the evil creepy doll and says, I'm not your wife, I am a god. So then we cut to the limo scene. Inside the limo, we see the FBI agent who shot and killed Dario last season. Dario's father, Antonio, is in there as well. Swagger, he's got the Lucha Underground Championship with him. Hexagon Black. And there's a mystery man, the mystery benefactor in the shadows, whose face we cannot see. Antonio learns in the scene that they asked Jake whose blood is it. And anyway, he finds out here that Matanza was killed, and you can see the look on his face. He's very upset to find out that his son has been murdered. And we finally learn who the boss man is in the shadows. He leans in. We hear a very familiar voice, and he leans in, and it's Stu Bennett, the former Wade Barrett. Yet another WWE mid-carder. He made reference to having bad news. I don't actually think that Barrett is actually wrestling anymore. So as a character like that, and with he's got a great voice, I actually think he's fine in that role. I don't mind him as much as I mind Swagger. But just the, I don't know, just the idea that Lucha Underground may die with Jack Swagger and Wade Barrett as the two focal points, it just doesn't seem right. So the montage ends with a flashback to 1 year ago when Antonio was, he took his son Dario's key. Remember, Dario was laying there. It was like the wake or whatever for Dario Cueto. He was dead. And his father reached in and grabbed the key. The key from Matanza that Dario had in his possession. And he closed the casket on his son and he walked off. We see Aerostar appear. This fucking guy is everywhere, isn't he? Soon we're going to have those Aerostars watching you masturbate memes. So he time traveled back to Dario's wake or funeral or whatever it was, and he places the amulet. Remember that the necklace, the two halves that he joined together? He takes the completed amulet and he places it around Dario's neck. And Dario then opens his eyes. He sits up in the casket, looks straight into the camera, and says, what the fuck? And they cut it off right before he could say the word, and they put the words, to be continued. Or so they say. As a cliffhanger, I thought that was great. I love that entire closing package, that last scene. I love the fact that Dario is alive again. I love the Dario Cueto character, so that was great. All that was great. And now, you know, if they do continue on, I would assume, you know, if they continue the storylines into the next season, I could see Dario almost taking on more of a babyface role and putting together a team of Lucha Underground originals to battle his father's crew, all the gods. Father against son. I think that could be a lot of fun. So a very entertaining finale overall. Very good finale. Now we wait and see what becomes of Lucha Underground in a potential fifth season. The whole to be continued thing is very much up in the air. Eric Van Wagenen is the executive producer of the show, and he appeared on the Masks, Mats, and Mayhem podcast, and he said on there that he doesn't know anything about a season 5 right now, which is always an encouraging thing to hear your EP say. I don't know what's going on. It sounds, based on what he was saying, if you read between the lines, it sounds like El Rey likes the show. El Rey likes Lucha Underground. They would love to continue Lucha Underground. Van Wagenen is not interested in rushing through another season like this most recent one on a slimmer budget. They really cut the budget for this last season. They had to tape a lot quicker. He doesn't want to do that. He says if it's a choice between doing that and not doing the show, it sounds like he'd be okay with just not doing the show. He would rather find another investor so they can get more money, get the budget back up to where it used to be, so it doesn't look like they're going for kind of a lower budget version of Lucha Underground. Even if they do get the green light for a fifth season, there's another issue. It sounds like Van Wagenen and Chris Roach, who is a producer on the show, who is also on that podcast, it sounds like they have two very different ideas on what a season five might look like. Van Wagenen says it would be more of a reboot. Ideally, it would be more of a reboot, and that includes rebooting the cast. You wouldn't have, not that they would get rid of everybody, but like he is thinking reboot. That's what he's thinking. Chris Roach would like to tie up all the loose ends storyline-wise, dating back to the very first season, before they do any sort of reboot. I'm with Roach. You've got to finish what you started with these stories. You can't leave this hanging, especially after this finale here and this little cliffhanger. I think it would be absolutely ridiculous to not first at least tie those stories up before you move on and reboot the cast and reboot the storylines. So I'm with him on that. But, you know, I thought there was one telling quote from Van Wagenen on that podcast where he said, good shows sometimes go away for business decisions, and shitty shows sometimes live on for business reasons. And I hope that Lucha Underground does not fall into that latter category. I get that this is how television works. There's more questions than answers. Nobody knows what's going on, and it's all about waiting for the money to come in. Like, I get that. Yeah, I'm not stupid. I understand that's how it works. But I think the fans of the show deserve better. They deserve better than to be left guessing if this is going to be the last episode of the show that they're ever going to see. Savage tweet of the week. You know, Becky Lynch has been killing it again this week on social media, going back and forth with Ronda Rousey, hyping their match at Survivor Series. But this week, the award goes to at Rebby Hardy, Matt Hardy's wife. It's been a while since we've had a good Rebby Hardy tweet to feature here. Well, that ended this week. Former WWE Diva Search winner Ashley Massaro, at Ashley Massaro 11 on Twitter, posted a tweet the other day, and she tagged Matt Hardy in that tweet. And in that tweet, she says, oh my goodness, so like, I'm going through my garage looking for old tax stuff. Yeah, good times, lol. And I find a box, including one CD burned for me by at Matt Hardy Brand from 2005. Currently listening to it, and it has some really good music on it. Only up to song 8 right now. Hope he and his fam are doing amazing. So, I don't know why Ashley Massaro suddenly sounds like a Valley Girl to me, but there it is. It's important to note here that Ashley dated Matt Hardy many years back when they were in WWE together, and Matt's wife does not like her. Like, at all. Rebby doesn't like a lot of people. Rebby doesn't like Lita, right? Someone posted a collage once on Twitter that happened to have a photo in it of Lita with Matt, and Rebby called her a hoe. Why are you tagging me in this with this hoe? She's got no love loss for any of these people, but Rebby saw this, and she responded with this. She said, last time we spoke, I said I'd knock you on your ass on sight. You want to pop up with hope your fam is amazing? Like you think I forgot you tried to come over here with pills while I was out of town in 2011? Bitch, fuck out of here. You may be running the Jesus gimmick these days, but I don't forget shit. That was 7 years ago. Rebby Hardy does not forget. And it didn't end there. Ashley replied back, sit down, Rebby, was living in New York in 2011 and nowhere near North Carolina. There was no aw, precious moments here. I simply stated that I found a CD from 2005 that Matt made from back in the day. No nostalgia, bless your heart, darling. Just you getting rowdy per usual. And P.S., knock my ass out on sight? Ha ha, yeah, okay, grow up. To which Rebby replied, because she's got to get the last word in, of course you retweet for everyone to see, LOL. You getting that attention that you were looking for, boo-boo? Yet you want me to sit down while you are out here publicly reminiscing about someone else's husband after all your shady bullshit. I know damn right where you was in 2011. I have screenshots of you asking for flights. Do I need to dig up the iPhone 4? Your crusty ass pops up every few years like a fucking herpes sore. It's played out. Grow up, LOL. Nah, bitch, I'm good. Try that bigger person pseudo-mature bullshit with someone else. I'll fucking pop you. Wow. Wow. If I lived in the same house with Rebbe, I would walk around on eggshells. That if I ever left a dirty dish in the sink, she'd slit my throat from stem to stern while I was sleeping. All right, let's get to your mailbag questions. You can email me thesolomonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from. City, country, state, not planet. Don't be a smartass. Start here with Dante from Indianapolis. A few weeks ago, you said there could be a real possibility that Roman Reigns may never wrestle again due to his battle with leukemia. If that was to be the case, do you think Roman has done enough to be considered a Hall of Famer? I know it may be a stupid question because we all know he'll go in, but I just want to know your honest opinion. So do I look at him as being a Hall of Famer? Because everybody has their own criteria for what constitutes a Hall of Famer. WWE has no criteria. They just put big names in. They put other names in. If they need people, it's just sort of a... On an as-needed basis, it feels like, right? Or if they have a PR need, they'll put a certain woman in or a celebrity in. The answer is yes, of course. Roman Reigns absolutely will be in the WWE Hall of Fame. He belongs in the WWE Hall of Fame, even though he didn't have the length on his career. Again, this is not Cooperstown or Canton. There's no specific criteria. You look at the guy's body of work, and in a very short period of time, he has headlined, four or five straight WrestleMania main events for this guy? Multiple time world champion? Intercontinental champion? A world tag team champion? Royal Rumble winner? He's a top guy. Worked with all of the top names in WWE of the last several years. Beat John Cena. He wrestled Randy Orton. He beat The Undertaker at WrestleMania. Brock Lesnar. AJ Styles. Seth Rollins, Dean Ambrose, I mean, you go up and down the list. And so, yes, even if his career were to end today, Roman Reigns not only will be in the Hall of Fame, of course he will be, but if it were up to me, I'd put him in the Hall of Fame. He's had a Hall of Fame career, whether it's a 4 or 5 year career or a 15-year career. You know, he's accomplished more in those 4 or 5 years than guys who have a 25-year career may accomplish. And they've been honored. Why should he be any different? Takim from Long Island, New York. Adam Cole is one of my favorite wrestlers. I think Triple H would push him, or at least try to. However, his height might hold him back on the main roster. Do you think Vince McMahon would push him? Yeah, he'd push him right off a frickin' cliff. This is one of the reasons right here. This is one of the reasons why I had pitched that Kevin Owens Undisputed Era idea a few months ago. After Owens quit Raw. And then the next week he unquit Raw. It would have been a plus for Adam Cole had they done that also, not just something new for Kevin Owens to do and people for him to work with, but for Cole, because, you know, it would involve a main roster guy with them. So for the Undisputed Era, it already gives them a leg up because they have an established main roster star, former Universal Champion, that they would be associated with. So automatically, right off the bat, even if you didn't know them from NXT, you would know that, okay, these guys are clearly being positioned as players, you know, on the main roster. It gives those guys a certain credibility. It protects them, I think, to a certain extent. Whereas Sanity comes up as a group and they get friggin' buried from week one, right? So that's part of what I liked when I pitched that idea. But without it, and obviously they're not doing that, my fear is that Adam Cole ends up as a top guy on 205 Live. His height is going to hold him back. His size is going to hold him back from any sort of a serious push on the main roster without Triple H having some kind of influence on him or helping him or pushing for him in some way. If it's all Vince McMahon, if we're just talking Vince and Kevin Dunn and that's it, I think Adam Cole is one of those guys, as probably are the rest of the guys in that group, who are going to have a ceiling as far as how high they can go. Dan from Bensonville, Illinois. I have completely given up on SmackDown doing anything with Luke Harper. What would you think if Baron Corbin brought in Harper as a hired gun against Braun Strowman? It would make sense that if anybody could impose a threat against Braun, it would be his older brother, quote-unquote, Luke Harper. What do you think? Well, I mean, it would give Harper something to do, at least. This thing with Strowman and Corbin is obviously going to continue for a while. I saw that the SAP Center in San Jose just updated their lineup. WWE gave them an updated lineup for TLC, which is coming up next month. And it had previously listed Braun Strowman against Drew McIntyre. Now, it lists Braun Strowman against Baron Corbin. Oh, joy. They also list, by the way, Seth Rollins against Dean Ambrose for the Intercontinental Championship. And Nia Jax challenging Ronda Rousey for the Raw Women's title. Actually, it just says Raw Women's Champion against Nia Jax. Doesn't actually mention Rousey by name. But Rousey, she ain't dropping that title before TLC. So anyway, moving Harper to Raw to get him on TV, fine with me. I don't see why, just because Rowan is out for all these months with another injury. What is this, number two, number three for him? I don't see why Luke Harper has to be punished, which in effect he is. I mean, he's still getting paid. You know, maybe he doesn't look at it that way, but there's no reason that Luke Harper should have to sit backstage and twiddle his thumbs until his partner is ready to come back. Jad from London, England. I just saw an article in the Sun newspaper on Facebook in which Ric Flair spoke to Sunsport, and when quizzed on whether or not he thought Wembley Stadium could host next year's Evolution event, he answered, "Who knows what's next? It'll be in a stadium, that's for sure. They could have sold out this year's event 2 to 3 times over. It'll be in a stadium, that's for sure." That's what he mentioned here in this quote. That's his opinion, by the way. I think that some people are looking at that as a stated fact. Clearly, if you read the article, this was a question that he got asked, and this was his opinion of things. Anyway, Jad wants to know, what do you make of this? If WWE has another Evolution pay-per-view next year, could it sell out a stadium, and would they do it at Wembley? Is there a bidding process involved, or is that just for WrestleMania? First of all, it's the Sun. That right there should tell you to take whatever you read in there with a mound of salt. Second, Ric Flair was giving a prediction, one that I predict is wrong. There is no guarantee that there will even be another Evolution pay-per-view. And if they do have one, I don't see it in a stadium. The only bidding process they have right now is for WrestleMania. And WrestleMania is an established brand. It's a proven brand. It's a proven event. No one is bidding on Evolution. Flair is making a prediction about something he wants to see. He wants to see his daughter in a big stadium on a grand stage. That's what he wants to see. That's why he would like to see it go to Wembley next year. I want a jetpack so I can get to work easier every day. Neither of these things will be happening next year. Shamira from Norristown, Pennsylvania. What do you think, or who do you think, rather, has a better chance of hosting a WrestleMania? England or Canada? Well, Canada's already had two of them. England's had none. So there's your answer. I say Canada has a better chance of getting it before the UK, getting it again before the UK gets it once. At the end of the day, it's all about the money. It's all about the money. If London or Manchester or one of these cities wants it more and they're willing to put a sweet package together to entice WWE to bring WrestleMania or whatever to the UK, then they'll get WrestleMania. It's less about time. I'm not saying time zones are not an issue at all, but it's less about time zones. Don't believe when you hear that it's all about the time zones. That's what's holding us back. No, it's not. It's an obstacle, but it's an obstacle you can get over if you get a sweet deal to bring WrestleMania overseas. It can be dealt with. If WWE was worried, let's say they're worried about the length of the show and having it start in the UK, you know, too early, because we have to get all 6 or 7 hours in of WrestleMania. You know, we want to get them all in before midnight. If that's one of their concerns, then you know what? Shorten the show. No one is clamoring for a 7-hour WrestleMania. I don't think you're going to get very many complaints if WrestleMania goes from a 7-hour show to a 5-hour show. And that way you could start it at, like, let's say 6 p.m. local time. So what is that Eastern? What's that, noon? Noon Eastern time it would start? You know, they have these things, these little events They're not too popular, but they have these little events in this country called NFL games. A lot of which start at 1 o'clock on Sundays. Sort of a tradition around here. And those games do pretty well. If WrestleMania started at noon, it wouldn't be the end of the world. It would be a little weird. But if you give people a card they want to see, they'll watch it live. Or, with the network, they can just watch it on a delay by a few hours. That's the beauty of the network. They also have the option of shortening the show by another hour if they wanted to. Make it 4 hours. And start it at 1 p.m. Eastern. That time of year, it's not like they're competing with the NFL. So you don't have to worry about that. It would be a minor inconvenience. That's how I look at it. Make it worth their while. Or, you know, promise to make it WWE week in London. Or something. Make them feel special. And I think England would have a good shot at it. Otherwise, it's going to be back in Toronto long before it ever comes to Wembley. Cedric from Baltimore, Maryland. Although I'm only 17 years old, I've recently discovered the work of Gino Hernandez. Had it not been for his death, do you think he could have been a star in WWE? Also, could you give your opinion on his death if you haven't done so already? I have talked about Gino on the show before. I'll talk about him again here. Gino Hernandez is one of the great what-if stories in wrestling. And he was before my time and also in a completely different territory. But I've watched his work and his promos. I've learned about him since then. Gary Hart, you know, before he passed away in his book, I know he talked a lot. He was very close with Gino. Couldn't even look at a picture of him after he died. It was just too much for him to bear. So I've become familiar with him, and by all accounts of people who knew him, of people who were fans of that territory back then and were familiar with his work, he is one of the great what-if stories. Again, I didn't have World Class when I was a kid. I didn't have access to it here in New York, I don't think. But you can find a bunch of his stuff on YouTube if you've not seen his work. If you're not really familiar with him, go on YouTube. This guy had every attribute that you could want in a pro wrestler if you were a promoter. He had the look, he could wrestle, he could run his mouth. He was real big in that world-class territory. Could he have been big in WWE? You know, I mentioned this earlier when I was talking about Jose Lothario. Jose Lothario passed away this week. He trained Gino Hernandez. The same man who trained Shawn Michaels trained Gino Hernandez. WWE was the land of the giants back then. Fat guys, roided up monsters, and they had literal giants. They had all kinds of people, but they were all mostly big or jacked. And those are the people who were more prominently featured. And yeah, you'd have a guy in there like a Tito Santana or somebody like that. Roddy Piper wasn't particularly jacked, although I'm sure he was on all kinds of shit. But Roddy was a special case in that he could talk. He could run his mouth, and so he did well. And you know, I mean, Randy Savage would be another one. Not a terribly big guy, but he had a unique look, and he could talk. So those guys were able to get over. And Gino could talk, too. So I can't say for sure if he came in, you know, he wouldn't have done well because he wasn't a giant or anything like that. Had he come in, maybe as part of a tag team, like Bret Hart did, like Shawn Michaels did, eventually he could have branched off on his own, then yeah, maybe he could have been a big deal. Those guys went on to become big deals, and I don't see why this guy couldn't have done the same thing. On his own, back then, in the mid-80s, we're talking like the early to mid part of the 1980s, I have my doubts. I have my doubts about how really big he could have gotten. I think he may have been a better fit in the NWA. Maybe I could see him as a four horseman. Right? I mean, am I the only one who feels that way? I think Gino Hernandez would have fit right in there. Would have fit in better than Paul Roma or Sid or some of the people who ended up in the Horsemen or Mongo. But I could see that. As far as his death goes, he died very young. He was in his late 20s. He died of a cocaine overdose. There are a lot of wrestlers who do not believe that Gino Hernandez died of an overdose. They believe he was murdered. Michael Hayes has spoken openly about this. In fact, when they used to do those old Legends shows, Legends of the Ring or whatever it was called, Legends Table, Round Table, whatever, which I think they should bring back, by the way. I wish they would bring those shows back. He talked about this on one of the episodes. He does not believe that Gino killed himself or accidentally overdosed. He thinks that he was murdered. And Jake Roberts. Jake Roberts is another person in Shoot interviews who has also said that he doesn't believe that Gino died of an overdose. They think he ended up hanging out with the wrong crowd. He pissed off the wrong people. Drug dealers, I presume. And that they killed him. And I guess maybe they staged it to, you know, look like an overdose. We'll never know for sure. We'll never know for sure. I'll take the medical examiner at his word and say that it was an overdose, because that's what all the evidence pointed to. He was heavy into cocaine. Everybody who knew him said he had a very big drug problem. He was, and a lot of guys in the 80s were big into cocaine, but Gino more so than most, from everything I've read, everything I've heard about the guy. Wherever he would have landed, though, I think he would have had a lot more success than he did. And, you know, if he was able to keep his drug habit in check, maybe had he not died when he did, the drugs would have ended up consuming him anyway. He could have flamed out early from that. But he had all the potential in the world to be one of the all-time great heels. Brandon from Longwood, Florida, has a non-wrestling audio question.
Hey, Solid Monster, this is Brandon Delgado from Longwood, Florida. It's been 10 years since Shea Stadium closed, so I was wondering, buy or sell, which one is your favorite, Shea Stadium or Citi Field? And second, since this week is David Wright's last season and that he's retiring, what do you think? Is he Hall of Fame worthy, or is he just one of those good Mets players that didn't get there all the way?
You can tell by Brandon's question that this has been sitting in my inbox for a while, since the baseball season is long over, and David Wright had his last game as a Met at the end of September, so I apologize it took so long to get to this, but I wanted to get to it now. I can vaguely remember the first, or one of the first games that my father took me to, you know, at the old Shea Stadium. I want to say it was in 86. It could have been 87. I still have my Mets yearbook that they made for 1987. It's around here somewhere. I know it's laying around here, so maybe it was 87. See, usually when I'm not sure about things like that, I would just check with my parents, and now I can't do that. So it's amazing all the family history that sort of goes right out the window when they're gone. And you think, man, I really should have written some of this stuff down. But anyway, I know 87 was my first WWF show. That I know. Anyway, I've been to Shea many, many times. And I've been to Citi Field now since it was created 9 or 10 years ago. I've been there many, many times. I've had the view in Citi Field from up in the nosebleeds. I've had the view from right behind home plate for a playoff game, which was incredible. I've had the view from inside the owner's box above home plate. That was incredible in its own way. So I've seen the game from all different angles inside that stadium. And Citi Field is a much nicer ballpark than Shea Stadium ever was. Shea Stadium was a dump. And people say, oh, yes, but it was our dump. Yes, it had a certain charm to it, but a dump is a dump. And that's what Shea Stadium was. Now, Citi is a lot newer, still, than Shea was when I first started going to games. But even still, I prefer Citi Field over Shea Stadium. The one thing I will say about Citi, they clearly had an obsession, the owners did, when they conceived of this stadium, with the Brooklyn Dodgers, and the old Ebbets Field. The exterior of the stadium looks like the old Ebbets Field. It was done that way on purpose. They have a lot of stuff honoring the Dodgers. I can remember a lot of people being up in arms when Citi first opened, that it felt like they were more interested in honoring a team that had left Brooklyn 50 years earlier than actually honoring their own team and their own team history. Less so now. I don't know that it's quite as bad now. They've added a Mets museum. They have other stuff there. But I'd have to agree. They went a little hard, I think, on all the Dodgers stuff. As far as David Wright goes, is he a Hall of Famer? He could be in the Mets Hall of Fame. He will be in the Mets Hall of Fame. I would say the Mets should probably retire the number 5 in his honor. He was the face of the franchise for a decade. He leads the team in a whole bunch of stats, too. In a lot of categories, all time, he is the leader. Hits, RBIs, like so many different things. He was a great ball player. By all accounts, he was an even better human being. He's not dead. I mean, he is an even better human being. I know the Mets, based on their history, they're not very keen on retiring too many numbers. Unlike the Yankees. I mean, for God's sake, I don't think the Yankees have any single numbers left. I think they're all retired. I think Jeter was the last one, right? Number two, and they retired his number, and that pretty much took care of 1 through 9. So they don't even have any single numbers left. Nobody can wear them ever again. In this case, the Mets should retire number 5. Davey Johnson wore number 5. So, even better. Kill two birds with one stone. Kill two birds with one number. And just retire the number 5. That being said, in my eyes, right, he falls short of Cooperstown. This isn't the WWE Hall of Fame where everybody gets in. I'm positive that had he not had his career cut short because of, you know, the spinal stenosis and all of that, had he kept going, I mean, he was on track for a Hall of Fame career. He absolutely would have gotten there if he could have stayed injury-free. But sadly, I don't think he makes the cut. I don't think he makes the MLB Hall of Fame. But the Mets Hall of Fame is, I mean, that's a gimme. One final question here. This is wrestling-related. Frank, in Atlanta, Georgia, I noticed you've been doing a lot of lists lately, and you mentioned the Mega Power storyline to be your favorite. What would your top long-term storylines be? So I was jotting some things down here. I didn't want to do like a formal list, top 10, rank them. That's not what this is. But I did jot down a bunch of long-term WWE storylines that I look at as being the best that this company has ever done. Mega Powers to me is definitely at or near the top of the list. It was perfect, you know. And from what I understand, Elizabeth had a lot of input into that even happening. I don't know how true that is, but I had always heard that it was her idea, or she had a lot of input into it. So I find that to be fascinating. But it kicked off in 87. I'm sure a lot of you old school fans remember the angle where Savage was being beaten down. Elizabeth left. She went to the back and she brought out Hogan. She grabbed him by the wrist and she's dragging Hogan to the ring. And that was the formation of the Mega Powers there in late 87. And they went through all of 88. Hogan was there when Savage won the championship at the end of WrestleMania 4. And slowly but surely, you got to SummerSlam. You got to Survivor Series. You could see the cracks in the armor. You could see where Savage was looking and growing jealous whenever he would see Hogan celebrating with Liz or they were posing together. And he had every right to be, because Hogan was, you know, a heel masquerading as a babyface. And I have no doubt that storyline-wise, he was trying to get into Elizabeth's pants. So I side with Macho Man. But anyway, that dragged into 89 and the big angle on the main event where they had the breakup and then the match at WrestleMania 5. So from start to finish, from a storyline perspective, I just thought that they did a masterful job with that. With two of the biggest stars in wrestling at the time, too. These weren't just two random individuals. Austin versus McMahon. These are not in any kind of particular order. Austin versus McMahon, how can you not put that on the list? Austin versus McMahon is in part what helped save the company. And Vince McMahon, he went on to become, in my opinion, the greatest heel character, the greatest heel performer that the business has ever known. That Mr. McMahon character. There's been a lot of great heels. But Mr. McMahon, at least in this company, Mr. McMahon, to me, there's been no better heel in wrestling than him. Austin was the perfect foil. He was the everyman. Drinks beer. Wears jeans. I mean, the everyman doesn't walk around wearing a leather vest. That's a little weird. But, you know, it was the perfect story of the boss that everybody hates. And you want to get one over on the boss. The boss is trying to fuck you over at every turn. And he would throw obstacle after obstacle after obstacle in Austin's way. And Austin would find creative ways to get back at him with a beer truck, with pouring cement into his Corvette, or as Jim Ross said, cement. Poured cement into the Corvette. And it was just a very entertaining storyline long term. It went on for quite a long time. So that has to be at or near the top, I think, of anybody's list. The sibling rivalry with Bret Hart and Owen Hart kicked off in the fall of 93. They did the angle at Survivor Series, the Harts against Shawn Michaels and the Knights, where Owen was the only Hart brother to be eliminated, and he blamed Bret for it. And they had a little tussle. And then they spent weeks trying to, like, patch things up. And finally, it looked like they were back on the same page. And I remember around Christmas time, they did a promo, oh, for the holidays, we're back together, you know, we're on the same page. And they built to the tag team title match against the Quebecers at the Royal Rumble, and that's where Owen kicked Bret's leg out of his leg. And Bret, up to that point, had said, I will not fight my brother. Even after that, I will not fight my brother. I will not fight Owen. And finally, he acquiesced, and he said, okay, I will give Owen that match at WrestleMania. And they had a fantastic match. It didn't end there. Owen went on to do what Bret did the year before. Anything you can do, I can do better. So they had Owen win the King of the Ring. He called himself the King of Hearts. It led to the cage match at SummerSlam, the best pure cage match that I've ever seen in WWE. I just watched it a couple weeks ago, actually. Just an awesome match, and everything after the match with the family members getting involved. It was great. And really, the sibling rivalry didn't end there. They kind of got away from it for a while, but it carried on for a while. It carried on for years. It never really went away. But the early stages of it, I thought, was just, again, masterfully done. Owen was really the perfect person. I cannot picture Bruce Hart in that role. Originally, it was conceived to be Bruce Hart and not Owen Hart, which I think Bruce, I have to think, if I'm Bruce, it's something that probably has bothered me ever since, because that could have been his big break in WWE. Bret didn't want to work with him. It was Bret who said, no, I don't want Bruce, I want Owen. He went to bat for Owen, and Owen got the spot. And I think it worked out better that way. Bret Hart and Jerry Lawler. How about their feud? Bret wins the King of the Ring in 93. Lawler shows up, spoils the celebration, and attacks him. And that builds to what was supposed to be a match at SummerSlam in 93. Then Lawler faked an injury. It was Bret against Doink. And by the way, don't sleep on that Bret Hart-Doink match at SummerSlam in 93. That's a great match. Doink had a great match with Marty Jannetty once on Monday Night Raw back in 93. Actually, I think they might have had two matches. Doink is very underrated. The original Doink. The original Matt Bourne. He had some good matches in that role. I don't think that he gets enough credit for that. But he had a good match with Bret, and then Lawler attacked him, and then it ended up being Bret Hart against Lawler, and he wouldn't let go of the sharpshooter, so the referee reversed the decision. Their feud, much like the Bret Owen one, they got away from it for a while, but it never really went away. It never really went away. It was supposed to be Bret and his family against Lawler and the Knights at Survivor Series. Shawn Michaels only got the spot because Lawler got arrested. I think he, I'm trying to think what that was. Was that the rape? I think that was the rape allegation. Yeah, I think that's around that time he was accused of some unsavory things, and eventually he came back, and they picked up with it. He would still insult Bret's parents on commentary, which was always funny. But then in 95, they had the Kiss My Foot match, which sucked, and then he brought in Isaac Yankem, and it kind of went downhill. But early on, I enjoyed the feud, and long term, I mean, it went on for like 2 years of the two of them hating each other and Lawler ragging on him. So that has to be on the list. Undertaker and Kane. Talk about sibling rivalry. We first heard about Kane in June of 1997. So you're thinking long term here. We first heard the name Kane mentioned. Kane is alive. Your brother is alive. Pretty sure that was June of 97. Kane did not debut until October of 97. Had one of the best debuts you could ever ask to have at that Hell in a Cell pay-per-view. And they went on, same thing. Undertaker did not want to fight his brother. He would let Kane punch him and beat him up. He was not retaliating. He did not want to fight his brother. This was like Bret Owen all over again. And they went to the Rumble. We thought they had patched things up. They were sort of working together. Kane came out to make the save for him. And then he put his brother in a casket and set it on fire. A little extreme, I would say. And finally, Undertaker eventually came back. He agreed to the WrestleMania. The more I think about this, this is in a lot of ways a carbon copy of the build to the Bret Owen match at WrestleMania. Undertaker and Kane went on to have 10,000 matches together after that, to this very day. You know, now they're partners. Eventually, Kane will turn on him again, and back and forth we go here 20 years later. So that has to be on the list. Bret Hart. I keep coming back to Bret, man. This is why Bret is my favorite. Bret is awesome. Great feuds, great matches. In 97, actually the end of 96 into 97, was his descent from hero to anti-American heel. And I would say you go back to, I guess you can go back to the fall of 96 when Austin was calling him out and calling him Shitman instead of Hitman on TV, and he coaxed him out of retirement. They had the match at Survivor Series. You know, at that point, you know, Austin was already starting to gain traction with the crowd. He was getting some favorable reactions, and he would cuss and he would flip people off, and Bret didn't like that. I'm sure in real life Bret didn't like that, but the character would talk about how you people cheer for this degenerate. He comes out and he curses and he drinks and all this other stuff. And maybe at that point he wasn't drinking at that point. But I think you could trace it back to that. I go back to the In Your House pay-per-view in December of 96. They did an In Your House show called It's Time. And the main event was Bret Hart against Psycho Sid for the WWF title, because by beating Austin, Bret had become number one contender. And Shawn Michaels was ringside doing commentary for the match. Well, Sid goaded Michaels into getting involved because he pie-faced him, and then he ran back into the ring. Well, Shawn gets up on the apron, and Bret gets whipped into the ropes and collides with Shawn. And he really collided face first with Shawn because Bret came up, his nose was all bloody. He might have had a broken nose. So his face slammed into Shawn's head. And he got powerbombed and he got pinned. And if you remember what happened when the match was over, Bret's got the bloody nose. He rolls out of the ring. He looks at Shawn. Shawn is standing right there. Shawn's got his back turned. He's trying to get his bearings back about him. But Bret is just staring a hole through him. And he kind of like goes to leave, but then he turns and he cold cocks Shawn. And like a hockey player, he pulls Shawn's shirt up over his head and just starts beating the crap out of him. He snaps. And I trace this turn of the Bret Hart character back to that event. And it wouldn't be the last time that we would see Bret snap. He got screwed in the Royal Rumble, came out and bitched about it the next night and quit. Pulled a Kevin Owens, by the way. Came back, I think, at the end of the show. So, long before Kevin Owens quit and then unquit the following week, Bret Hart did it first. And then Bret got screwed again after he won the championship because Austin whacked him in the head with a chair and he got pinned and Sid won the belt back. Bret, if you look back at that character, had every reason to bitch and complain because he got screwed over at every turn. Shawn cost him the championship by being up on the apron. He eliminated Austin from the Royal Rumble match. Nobody saw it. Austin came back in, threw him out, won the Rumble. Bret wins the championship back in the Final Four match. He gets hit in the head with a chair by Austin the next night, loses the championship 24 hours later. He had every right to be pissed. Look at the cage match. 6 days before WrestleMania 13, Bret Hart against Sid. Austin runs down. Undertaker runs down. Bret gets screwed again. Then he really snapped. Shoved Vince McMahon down. He's cursing. Tells people tough shit. If you don't like it, tough shit. Tells Austin, your stones are so cold, you don't have the guts to come out and fight me. This happened 6 days before WrestleMania. That was sort of like their Hail Mary. There wasn't a whole lot of interest, I don't think, going into that WrestleMania shit. That did not do very well, that pay-per-view. But that was crazy. And then so WrestleMania comes and goes, right? And then we get Bret Hart on TV, and that's where he cuts his promo on the American wrestling fans. The American wrestling fans from coast to coast can kiss my ass. And he reunites with Bulldog and Owen. And he's got that mischievous look on his face, like he's just using them. He doesn't give a shit about them. But that's the formation of the Hart Foundation. And anyway, I mention all of this. I know I'm like waxing eloquently about this storyline, but it really was a storyline. It wasn't America versus Canada. I'm not even talking about that. That was part of a bigger storyline. And the bigger storyline was Bret's descent into madness. You could trace it back to the end of 96. And it played out into the first 4 or 5 months of 97, then the heel turn came. And it just went from there. That is great long-term character storytelling that we don't really see much of these days. In WWE, anyway, you just don't see it. And that would be on my list as well. The two other ones I would mention real quick. Batista, his slow burn turn, heading into the feud with Triple H in early 2005 when they had the WrestleMania 21 match. I know things were set up for Randy Orton to be the guy to try to get the championship back. He had been Ortoned, and he was done for. He was doing the concussion thing where he was constantly being concussed. Batista, in the meantime, kind of low-key, caught fire. People loved him. He had a unique look. And he was kind of he could be a funny guy. Remember, he would kind of joke with Triple H. Triple H would take him seriously. Like, you know, you owe me. Where's my $100? Remember they did that thing on Raw? Where's my $100? Like, Batista went out. There's some kind of bet, and he won. Triple H was like, what? He goes, where's my money? I want my money. But then he was like, nah, I'm just kidding. Like, little things like that. It was a slow burn. It was a slow burn to Batista winning the Royal Rumble and doing the thumbs up, thumbs down, going babyface. And it led right into WrestleMania 21. And that pay-per-view, that main event, I think gets a lot of credit, did big business. I think they did over 1 million buys that year. So I would put that on there. And lastly, the Shawn Michaels-Chris Jericho feud in 2008. Some of the best storytelling that they've done in the last 20 years. And mostly put together, not by the creative monkeys in the back there, but by Jericho and by Michaels. They were the ones who put that whole thing, by and large, together. They did the angle where Jericho accidentally punched Shawn's wife in the lip at SummerSlam, and she got a fat lip from it. And hey, even before that, you know, the stuff where, you know, Jericho didn't really buy that Michaels was injured. Michaels was sort of faking a knee injury, and Jericho was bothered by the fact that the fans don't seem to mind it when you lie to them. Then he put Michaels through the glass, the Geritron. It's funny. There's this urban legend. People are like, how come Shawn Michaels is cross-eyed? When did he get cross-eyed? They're like, well, it's because Chris Jericho put him through the Geritron 5,000 or 6,000 or whatever the hell it was. And therefore, that gave Shawn Michaels the googly eye. Shawn Michaels was already going cross-eyed before that. I mean, maybe he was hurt a little bit in the attack. Maybe he did suffer some kind of minor injury. But this idea that, like, it was caused by that angle is so friggin' preposterous. But anyway, although Jericho might take credit for it, it's kind of funny. And everything built up. They had, the ladder match for the World Heavyweight Championship. It was such a great feud. It went on for, like, 5 or 6 months. It was just great, great stuff. And I would put that on the list as well. So, would love to hear from you guys. I'm sure I'm missing a whole bunch. Long term, let's keep it to WWE, though. Long term storytelling in terms of a feud, a character that changed over an extended period of time. I'm sure I'm missing a bunch, but let me know what your list might look like. Keep sending in your questions. TheSolomonster@gmail.com is the place to send to. I did a review of last week's Walking Dead episode. The season's not over yet, but it was a big episode because, you know, one of the main characters was going to be leaving the show. I won't say more than that, although, you know, AMC was hyping it up. They kind of spoiled it themselves for weeks and weeks. So because of that, I wanted to do a review. That is up on the YouTube channel if you missed it, or if you're in the middle of catching up on the seasons of The Walking Dead and you want to hear my review of that, it's up on the YouTube channel. It went up late last Sunday, so you can find that on there. I'm not planning on reviewing these last three episodes of the season, unless I feel compelled to because they're so great. It was just meant to be a one-time thing. I mean, I'm open to doing more reviews like that if I get good feedback from you guys, if that's the sort of thing you want to see me do more of. But I'm not planning on reviewing these next three episodes, just so you know. But definitely keep it locked to the YouTube channel. There's been a ton of new content that's gone up there, in part because we've had so many pay-per-views in such close quarters. There'll be Survivor Series next week, and that review will be going up as well. I want to do more Sound of Gamer episodes. I've got a few ideas in my head that I'm going to try to make happen. So go to the YouTube channel. Please, please hit the subscribe button. We just passed 42,000 subs and climbing each and every day, thanks to you guys. I will be back with a brand new episode of the podcast next Sunday. That is episodes, what are we up to here? 573. That will be Survivor Series predictions. We have another pay-per-view already. Another pay-per-view coming up next weekend. I'll talk about NXT TakeOver as well. I'll just wait. I may as well. I mean, the event's Saturday night. I'm doing a show Sunday morning, so my TakeOver thoughts and review will be part of the show next week as well, so a lot of good stuff coming up. Until then, be well, stay safe, have yourselves a fantastic week, and I will see you back here again, as always. It's Sunday, you know what that means. What does Luke Harper say on his Twitter every day? He's like, it's Monday, you know what that means. It's Wednesday, you know what that means. If it's Sunday, tweet Luke Harper and you let him know what that means. And I'll see you guys back here next week. Take care.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. The Salamonster sounds off.
This Impact show has moved so many times. It's got more fucking moves than Bruno Mars, this show does. Don't believe me, just watch. Impact started out on Friday, then moved to Saturday, Thursday, then they moved it to Monday. They got slaughtered, so they moved it back to Thursday, then they moved it to Wednesday, Friday again, then back to Wednesday, Tuesday, and now back to Thursday. It's like the Big Show of TV shows. It's turned 1,000 times already, and the only time people pay any attention to it is when it makes them laugh.
Salamonster sounds off. Since 2007, the Salamonster sounds off. Available at thesalamonster.com, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and more.
Solo Monsters sound off.